What we're witnessing here is lawfare and the weaponization of the legal system. I was the test case for what's now being done to President Trump, Steve Bannon, and others. This is an attempt at digital assassination. I never said or did any of the things they claimed on Sandy Hook. Two judges in Texas and Connecticut found me guilty by default and then had literal show trials on how guilty I was. The $1.5 billion verdict is a fraud. The judges had already told the juries that I was guilty. Now we've been in bankruptcy for almost 2 years, proving that everything they claimed about me having hundreds of millions of dollars was not true. Notice you don't hear about that anymore. None of that was true. And now, instead of wanting the money that is there, the so-called plaintiffs, who really aren't the families, it's the government that's been behind it, that's come out in court, want me silenced. They said on the courthouse steps, the plaintiff's lawyers, in Texas and Connecticut, we want Alex Jones silenced. That's what this is all about. This is about the destruction of the First Amendment in America. And now, the plaintiff's lawyers, Democratic Party lawyers out of Connecticut, have filed today to try to take real Alex Jones on X away from me. Now they want my identity. Under the terms of service of X, you cannot do that because it's my own personal property. These people want me silenced. It is completely and totally transparent, and the world is seeing through this. I was asked by one reporter earlier, is this the end? This is probably the end of InfoWars here very, very soon, if not today, in the next few weeks or months. But it's just the beginning of my fight against tyranny. As the founder of the U.S. Navy said during the Revolutionary War, John Paul Jones, when his ship, about a third the size of the British ship he was fighting, was starting to sink, and the British officers held a cross on their bullhorn and said, "Would you like to surrender?" And he said, "Surrender? I have only begun to fight. People know I've been right. They know what I really cover. Tens of millions of people a day want to hear what I actually have to say, not what the corporate media says. The corporate media have become mercenaries for the globalists, for BlackRock, for the WEF, and the public knows that. So the power structure, not just here, but around the world, is in full collapse. The corporate media is basically dead and a shadow of its former self because it's become a prostitute of the big corporations and tried to wage war against the independent popular press. All the most popular hosts, not just here but around the world, are populist anti-globalists. Whether it's Tucker Carlson or Joe Rogan or Alex Jones or Russell Brand, the list goes on and on. Joe Rogan has an audience 100 times that of CNN. I have an audience 15 times that of CNN. Tucker Carlson has an audience 100 times the size of CNN. CNN and other corporate media like it are zombies. They are empty husks that no one believes or listens to anymore. And so this is a desperate deep state attempt using lawfare to shut me down and silence me. Judge Lopez has been fair. He's followed the law. He's been very frustrated by the fact that the plaintiffs do not want money and have admitted it and have only used the bankruptcy process to try to torture me and harass me. It's done the opposite. My resolve against this tyranny has never been stronger, and I will not be silenced. I'm given hundreds of interview opportunities a day. I've got all these incredible groups that want to work for me or work with me. And now this information coming out and this open, naked attempt to silence me has blown up in their face. So the judge today could rule to put this into a Chapter 7 free speech systems and appoint a trustee and begin to shut it down the next few days or weeks. Or he can hand me back the company. They're still going to be attacking at the state level and trying to shut it down. Regardless, InfoWars is not the operation. Alex Jones and my crew and my listeners and my viewers and our guest is the operation. And that's why this is only going to make me stronger, and I will never surrender in this information war. And as Colonel Travis said, victory or death. We are winning. The people are winning. The corporate media is lying. And I'm shooting this right now for the start of my show today, 11 a.m. Central. Coming up today, in just a few minutes, we're going to have the interview I did yesterday for an hour and 40 minutes with the great Tucker Carlson. Then another hour-long interview with Russell Brand and more. And then by then, this hearing should be over, and I should be back in the fourth hour into the war room today. But they could shut us down this afternoon. I want to commend the crew. I want to commend our listeners. I want to commend our supporters. I know there's congressional hearings coming up on what's been done to me. Well, I've interviewed a lot of amazing people. I've interviewed President Trump, you name it, and I never get butterflies. But for this interview, I do. I absolutely love Tucker Carlson. He's changed the world. He is the top political commentator in the world, hands down, and in his incredibly busy schedule, he has decided to give us about an hour and a half interview here today. And this is in the twilight of InfoWars. We could be imminently shut down. So I can't see us going out better than with Tucker Carlson also coming up today. It's How the Planets Aligned. Russell Brand is going to be on with us as well. So this is going to be an incredible broadcast here today. It'll all be posted, obviously, at Real Alex Jones on X. But Tucker Carlson does not need any introduction. And I want to just talk Tim, first about the future of humanity, the future of America, World War III, the fact that the dinosaur media is officially dead and is trying to claw the rest of us with them, and how we turn not just American civilization, but the entire world civilization around from this globalist death cult that is in control of our lives today. So, Tucker, thank you so much for the time, my friend. Of course, you've announced a big nationwide tour that I'm very proud to be a small part of. Just so much going on. Your network is exploding. I know you don't ever talk about Fox getting rid of you, but, man, it's got to feel vindication and good that I would say you reach about 10 times more people now than when you were on Fox. So it's great to have you.
Well, thank you. It actually felt good the first day. I enjoy being fired, actually, because it forces you to stop doing what you're doing and take an assessment. I'm honored to be here. I'm here, obviously, because we're friends, but I'm really here on principle, because there's nothing you've ever said in your entire life or done in your entire life that's scarier or more threatening to our country than what they're doing to you right now. So the government taking a broadcaster off the air who's committed no crime because he dares to criticize them, is the scariest possible thing, and it's the clearest possible sign of tyranny. And I am heartbroken that this isn't getting more attention. I think it's a pivot point in our country, and if they can do this to you, they will do it to the rest of us. And what's so striking, though, is that if you had spent the last 20 years attacking, I don't know, the white working class, right? Or the country, America, its founding documents, Thomas Jefferson, you know, you'd be lauded, but you did the one thing you're not allowed to do, which is you attack the people in charge. And that's why they're trying to take you off the air. And I think we should be really clear about that. You've never done anything but attack the people in charge. That's your crime. By the way, if you had started a war that killed a million people or tanked the U.S. economy or, you know, sort of looted every American's bank account through the Federal Reserve, you would be getting a Presidential Medal of Freedom. But you criticized the ruling oligarchy and they're trying to crush you. So I hope every person of principle, every decent person in this country, whether they agree with what you say or not, whether they like you personally or not, it doesn't matter. Will say out loud, no, you can't do this in my country, the country that my ancestors built, that I was born in. You can't take people off the air because they criticize you, because that's tyranny.
Well, I want to just thank you, because when I first got deplatformed 5 years ago, almost no one who was prominent came to my aid and said, hey, they're going to get everybody if we allow this to happen. And they obviously misrepresented what I supposedly did. It was all a big PR campaign. They've now admitted to that. They've admitted in Reuters last week that the goal was to take me off air. They never wanted to settle with me. It was basically a Democratic Party witch hunt. But shifting gears out of me, I mean, I totally agree with you. This isn't about Alex Jones or Tucker Carlson or Donald Trump or Steve Bannon. It's about they have to get through us to get to the public, as Trump always says. And it really is a canary in the coal mine that they're so hysterical and so desperate and know that they've lost control of the narrative that they're just willing to do anything. The lawfare, all the fake charges, all the criminality. But I want to speak to all of that. But you never really talk about yourself. And people find that fascinating. People want to know about you. So let's go back to what you first said. You loved being fired. I mean, when I said 10 times bigger than you were, you were huge, but you're definitely 10 times conservatively bigger, reaching 500, 700 million people with your shows, normal shows, 50 million. I mean, that is massive. Instinctively, when you got unceremoniously fired at Fox, they wouldn't even tell you why, very Kafka-esque. Why was that so exciting to you? And now what is it like to be fully the captain of your ship?
Well, I mean, of course, it's painful. You know, it's always painful to, you know, have anything unexpected happen in your life because you think, you know, you can see the future. But it's really a blessing to be reminded that you can't and that things changed abruptly, that you don't have control really over most of your life. and you certainly don't have control over history. So you're just sort of flotsam, bobbing along, trying to make the right decisions moment to moment. The reason that I liked being fired, within like 20 minutes, I was in a good mood because I recognized the pattern. It's always the bad things that turn out to be the greatest things in your life. You know, it's getting really sick and surviving. It's, you know, it's something you didn't expect at all that hurts, that forces you to take an assessment of what you're doing and change. And you won't change unless that happens. I mean, there's really nothing worse for people, particularly for men, than just succeeding, because it ratifies all of your decisions. It makes you, you know, after a while, you just like confuse yourself for Jesus. You just think, well, I'm successful because I'm just so great. You know, I earned this. I'm like, I'm an amazing person, unlike everybody else. And I think it's absolutely vital for your soul, but also for your clear judgment to remember, no, I'm this sort of ungainly, ridiculous primate who lucked into some things, made some good decisions, a lot of bad decisions. Like, see yourself in context. See yourself as you really are. You know, you're absurd. We're all absurd. And so getting fired just reminds you, like, oh, I'm so important. You know, I get all these people texting me like, I can't believe they fired you. They needed you. Well, it turned out they didn't actually. And it's good to be reminded of that, like, you think you're such a big deal. Will anyone remember your name in 50 years, in 10 years? Will anyone visit your grave? I know the answer. No. So I'm not saying that to sort of pose as a self-deprecating person. I'm saying that because it's factually true. And it's good to operate on the basis of what's true rather than on what you wish were true.
Well, I mean, as I've grown up, I'm 50 now. I was never ego-driven completely, but I was more ego-driven as I was younger. It's such a strength and way more satisfying to have the ego basically drop away to almost nothing and to really have it be a sense of community. And that's your power that comes off so genuine, and it's even stronger in person, folks, is that you really are a genuine person who's humble. And so we're not lauding ourselves. It's just a great attribute. If you look at the globalists in D.C., which I know you know well, they are the complete opposite. They are on delusional, crazy power trips. And to me, there's nothing more dangerous than that with people that are megalomaniacs and think they're invincible, who also have nuclear weapons.
Exactly. There's nothing. Really, that's the way that people destroy themselves. I mean, humans are distinct from the animal kingdom in one meaningful way. They kill themselves. Animals don't. You know, no dog has ever decided to, you know, to kill himself. It just never occurs to a dog or to a porcupine or to any other animal, only to people. And they always kill themselves in the same way, by imagining they have powers they don't, mistaking themselves for God. And I mean, this is just the most consistent theme in all history. And again, men are prey to it in a way that women generally aren't. Obviously, Torian Newland would be a huge exception, Hillary Clinton. I mean, there are exceptions, but the male temperament is particularly susceptible to the delusion that, you know, I'm Jesus. And those people are the most dangerous. And you're right, when they have the power to destroy the world, which they do, you know, they're terrifying. And we are, by the way, just since you brought it up, we are on the cusp of nuclear war with Russia right now. We are actually on the cusp. We are closer to nuclear war right now than any time in history, far closer than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the reason is really simple. We're targeting mainland Russia. We are attacking Russia, the nation. We are in a hot war with Russia. So from Putin's perspective, which is basically unknown in the United States, and they're completely committed to preventing you from knowing what Putin thinks or says. But if you pay any attention at all, you know that Putin is dictatorial, of course. He is not an absolute monarch. He is not Kim Jong-un. Putin cares a lot about his approval rating in Russia, a lot. That's why he controls the media in Russia. And Putin has, for 2.5 years, done everything he can to minimize news within Russia of attacks within Russia. There have been a bunch of assassinations, for example, in Moscow, carried out by the Ukrainian intel services. That's a fact, okay? Dugin's daughter was murdered with a car bomb in Moscow. There have been others. And Russian media has ignored those attacks. Putin does not want to seem weak in front of his country, in front of the Russian people, period. And so my point is, Russian media, if you watch it, has been downplaying NATO attacks on Russia. If there is a NATO attack within Russia that he cannot keep from his people, it becomes obvious that he can't protect mainland Russia from NATO. He'll launch a tactical nuke into Ukraine, a nuclear weapon into Ukraine for the first time in 79 years. We are very, very, very close to that. And if that happens, of course, it'll set off a chain reaction, and we'll have a nuclear war in which you and I and our children will die. And so we're right there, right now. And that's not reported anywhere in the U.S. media. Our leaders either know it and don't care because they're on a suicide trip. I agree with you, I think. But the average person is not bent on suicide, doesn't want to die, doesn't want his kids to be incinerated, doesn't want to live in a post-nuclear wasteland. And the average person has no idea that that's happening right now. And I just think it's the most astounding thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
And if you add to that, Biden not knowing what planet he's on, and for people that don't know, you've studied this, your guests have studied this, mainline analysts agree we're the closest nuclear war we've ever been, and we have an establishment that has this normalcy bias that they're invincible or that Russia will back down. You're absolutely right. Putin, for those that don't study the situation, is a moderate and is restraining the hardliners, and the vast majority of Russians, over 80%, want full-out war. And people that don't know, Hitler went to be defeated in Russia, Napoleon, the Russians were the frontier with the East and stopped all these Mongol and then Islamic invasions. And so the Russians are very serious when it comes to being attacked, and they will attack. And so this is not like some, you know, Iraq where we've cut off the resources and are, you know, murdering them with starvation and they can't fight back. This is the largest nuclear power, and this is beyond playing with fire or poking a bear. This is I was texting you a few weeks ago and I said, yeah, it's World War III, and you said it's the final war. And I think that term, I hadn't heard that before. It's right. We had World War I that was the war to end all wars. We learned it wasn't, but this would be the final war, as you know, your very famous quantum mechanics expert once said. I don't know how World War III will be fought, but I know that World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
That's right. No, I think that's absolutely right. And the funny thing is that you and I grew up in a country where that was a commonplace observation, like all through school, you know, our entire lives up until about 25 years ago, when, you know, the United States became the unipolar power, we were told, and it was true, that nuclear war was the end of humanity. And it was the thing to fear most. And all of a sudden it became this thing that the entire foreign policy establishment in Washington, CSIS and everyone in the National Security Council and just sort of the permanent foreign policy thinkers in D.C. wave away as, you know, not possible, whatever, you're being hysterical, even as they tell us that Vladimir Putin is dying of Parkinson's disease, is deranged, is a crazed megalomaniac on a death trip. You know, he cannot be trusted. You cannot have a negotiation with him because he's that crazy. They're saying that this guy, who's by their own description that crazy, will not launch any of his 6,000 nuclear warheads against the West. I mean, it's the villain in this story, whatever you think of Putin, and I'm hardly defending Putin, but the villain here is NATO and the National Security Council in Washington, because they are pushing our country and the West to annihilation. And that's a fact. That's not, I'm not being, you know, hysterical or trying to, you know, upplay it or sell it, you know, as a threat that we should all be worried about. This is an imminent danger to human existence, and we're at the most fraught moment in all of human history right now. It's shocking to me that the Today Show and Good Morning America and the New York Times and the Washington Post don't begin every story, no matter what the topic, with, you know, by the way, we're on the cusp of nuclear war, because there's nothing more important than that. But they don't. They hide it.
And by the way, when you say one more thing, you're very gracious when I've been on your show and just let me go on for 20 minutes of time. We want the deep Tucker Carlson. People love the Joe Rogan. One of the most viewed interviews ever. I've seen 100 million views, folks. I watched it twice. My wife watched it twice. My full family, everybody I know has been talking about it. And Joe's great. He's better than I am at interrupting. But I want to be even better than Joe. I want to give you time to keep elaborating on this, because you've really done a lot of research into this. And I want to get back into the suicide death cult nature of the globalists. Yes. And why they're so nihilistic, why they're doing this, and how they see a nuclear war as some survivable thing for them, and then it'll get rid of the population, and they'll reemerge. And the Wall Street Journal, even with headlines, looking forward to the end of humanity, and in just hundreds of headlines about humans are a parasite, let's get rid of them, and then the horrible, sick things they do. Like, this is really, at the end of the day, a spiritual battle, and you've talked some about that in your guest tab, but that's, I want you to really go deep on this today.
Well, I mean, I think the framework that most of us internalized growing up in this country was evolutionary biology, the idea that human behavior is the product of millions of years of adaptation to the environment, and we like things, we don't like things, because our ancestors had a need to like or dislike those things. And it makes sense, and I think to some extent it's true. But the bottom line imperative in evolutionary biology is survival. You know, the whole point of existence is to pass on your genes to another generation and you know, continue the line of humanity. So, and I think that's right, actually. I think that is our instinct. So whenever you see people who are pushing for the end of humanity, pushing for suicide, you know that the controlling power is, by definition, not human. I'm trying to approach this logically here. Like, what are we watching? And I don't think that we're watching the product of human greed here, for example. And a lot of people, and I've been one of them many, many times, say, well, you know, the real story here, you know, the real reason this is happening is because Larry Fink is going to buy all the farmland in Ukraine and he's going to make a ton of money for BlackRock. Or the reason, you know, we have so many transvestite children is because the, you know, hormone makers are making a bundle on this. Or the reason they're pushing the COVID vax is because Moderna and Pfizer are getting rich. I mean, on one level, that is all true, of course. But it's not what's driving it. No one is going to survive a nuclear exchange. The people who are pushing us, no one on the National Security Council is going to have a better life if there's a nuclear war. Everything that they know and love will be gone, including their own children. So this is not actually something they're doing for their own benefit, whether they know it or not. They're being driven to do it by spiritual forces. I mean, if there's another explanation, by the way, I'm completely comfortable having grown up a secular person in a secular country with a secular explanation for what we're watching. And if you can think of one, tell me what it is. But I can't. I don't see any rational reason. I don't see any actual self-interest that could be motivating the desire to commit mass suicide. I just don't. And I would, by the way, say that the transgender, the tranny stuff is a form of mass suicide. You're preventing your children from having children. Therefore, you go extinct. I mean, right? At scale, that's what we're watching.
Having our sons cut their genitals off and little girls cut their breasts off.
That's exactly right.
It's like something out of a Clive Barker novel. It's like Hellraiser. So let's bring in all the politics.
No, but can I just say, it's not just hurting your children, it's hurting you, because the deepest desire of every parent is to have grandchildren, not just for sentimental reasons, but for biological reasons, to see your line continue. That is the most natural of all instincts. So when you see somebody act against that, then you know this is probably not a human impulse, right? This is unnatural. This is, in fact, I would say, supernatural. And that's exactly, in my view, what it is. Unless you can think of some better secular explanation that we can, you know, measure in the lab. But I can't. And I've thought about it a lot.
I've heard you talk about this some, but can you elaborate on growing up Episcopalian? You know, you were never a Satanist. You kind of believed in God from what I've heard, but weren't sure about it and liked the idea of Christianity. But then you've told me some of your private stories. I told you some of mine. We're not going to get into those here. But the process of you in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, really communicating what everybody else is feeling and seeing. Either you're totally in the matrix and don't see any of it and do whatever you're told and you will eat the bugs and, you know, love all this evil. And that's a smaller and smaller group. Or there's the majority of us, really, they don't have all the answers, but are trying to figure this out. What was that process like for you coming to this realization that it's good versus evil and that there are forces other than human?
Well, I mean, it's a process still. I mean, and by the way, one of the reasons I'm uncomfortable talking about it is because I hate to sort of hold myself up as an advertisement for the world's largest faith. Or pretend to be a spokesman for God. I think you bring disaster upon yourself when you do that, I've noticed. I mean, there's a reason that preachers are disproportionately likely to get caught up in sex scandals or get addicted to porn or smoke meth, or, you know, they're under attack. The second you say, I represent a billion Christians, you are under attack. And so I certainly don't represent a billion Christians or Christianity or Jesus or anything like that. I'm as flawed as anybody you'll ever meet, more than most. And so I just want to say that with sincerity at the outset. But to answer your question, you know, I always believed that the sum total of everything was probably a little bit bigger than what we could measure, you know, that our senses don't tell the whole story. And I've always believed in the possibility of a God, of supernatural forces, because it seemed obvious to me. And it's obvious from your own experience in life. You somehow know things intuitively. Well, how could you know that? You know, it's encoded in our genes. Really, tell me how that works exactly. You can't. Nobody can. So clearly, there's a lot more going on than science, as understood in 2024, can explain to us, obviously. And I've always assumed that was real, because it clearly is real. But I didn't have much of a coherent theology other than, you know, I'm a Christian. I went to sort of a church that didn't mean it. I didn't quite realize how much they didn't mean it. But I'd grown up in this church and gone to its schools, and I was really steeped in the culture of the church, and my family was involved in the church going back, you know, a couple hundred years. So it was like, it was very much part of our family. And, but I didn't think about it very much. And really it was watching what's happening to the world that changed my view. I became convinced that some of these, I had watched political debates my entire life. That's what I do for more than 30 years. And while I disagreed with one side, I could understand their argument. You know, they would say, well, we need to have, I mean, I've always been totally opposed to abortion or killing the defenseless, really killing anybody, honestly, except in self-defense. But I could understand, you know, well, there's a 15-year-old girl who, you know, was pregnant, she got raped, and if you don't let her have an abortion, she'll never have a real life. And, you know, I disagreed with that because I think you can't kill people regardless of the justification. However, I thought that was a real argument. I mean, at least it appealed to the possibility her life would be improved. You wake up and all of a sudden people are saying, well, abortion is itself the point. Like having an abortion is just good for the sake of doing it.
That's right. The women say we love it. They say we love it. It's a religion. They're getting off on it.
Well, it's human sacrifice. And so obviously, I was trying, because I'm a little bit autistic and very literal, I'm thinking, well, okay, what does that even mean? Like, what?
You were trying to find
logic.
This
is very different. I was, and I'm a student of argument because I make arguments for a living. I spent years, you know, sending my kids to school and filling the fridge with arguing. That's what I did for a living. So I really am interested in how people construct arguments and in their nature. And all of a sudden, people stop making arguments on behalf of abortion and begin holding it up as just like something that was just good for its own sake. And stop. They didn't even attempt to convince you that you weren't taking a human life. The presumption is that you are, of course. And with technology, we know that you are. There's no counter argument to that. And so they're basically saying killing people is a good thing. And I thought, well, that's just a kind of a remarkable thing to say. And then I found out, because I was interested, that that is what every society has said in recorded history. Every society, from the ones that, you know, are very famous, the ancient Canaanites, the Mayans, the Aztecs, all the Mesoamerican civilizations, but also the Western European civilizations, my own, where my ancestors lived, you know, in the Nordic countries. They were also committing human sacrifice. There's something about killing other people ritually as an offering to the spirit world that is a constant through human history. Every civilization has done that. And so that raises the question, why? How would, like, that's such a counterintuitive conclusion to come to. I kill people. Like, so evolutionary biology tells us that the whole point of existence is to continue existence, is to pass on your genes to another generation and then many more, right? That's the assumption that I had my whole life. And yet every civilization from the beginning of time has reached the opposite conclusion. We will be happier by killing the fruit of our womb, children, and we will be rewarded by the gods for doing this. Every single civilization has reached that conclusion without any exception that I'm aware of. And you have to ask, why is that? They didn't have the internet 5,000 years ago. How are they all reaching the same conclusion? And really the only logical answer is because some outside force was telling them that, right? That the spirit world is real and that there are demons telling people that you will be happier, that you will be safer, that you will be richer, you'll be more powerful if you take the life of a child or of a maiden or of some helpless human being. Mostly young human beings. It's never the elderly who are the...
And they like it because it's stealing the future, and a child is the closest thing to God because of the potential of the universe. So it is a wound exactly. Against God. It is stabbing God.
Exactly. Exactly. But civilizations convince themselves of all kinds of crazy things, right? But when every civilization convinces itself of the same crazy thing, that is not an obvious conclusion. Like if I'm, you know, a Jivaro Indian living in the Amazon headwaters and just getting enough calories every year is really a struggle, right? And I need labor because there aren't many Jivaro Indians, but I've somehow reached a conclusion that killing my own child would, you know, make my life better. Like, how am I reaching that conclusion? Like, I'm not reaching that rationally. Something or somebody is telling me that.
And you made a key point. You made a key point. That these are civilizations that we're not communicating, and they're doing the exact same thing.
Exactly.
Many times the exact same image of the same gods. And so you've told me some private stories.
So often.
I've told you some private ones. And through my life, I have a sixth sense, the spirit, It's not instinct. It's something else. And I've had this happen all the time. I usually ignore it. I've learned to not ignore it. And I mean, here's just an example. And this is literally from the ether, from God. I can play the clip. About a month before he got fired, I said, Tucker will be fired within 1 month. And I believe Tucker. He's hardcore. He's awake. The left admits it. I predict he won't be at Fox News in the near future if he's unable to put this out. I'm going to leave it at that. By the way, Fox News needs Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson doesn't need Fox News.
And we'll be back on Monday. In the
meantime, Tucker Carlson signed off Friday on what we now know was his last show on Fox News. The network announcing it is severing ties with its most popular host without explanation in a statement Monday.
And I've just learned when this stuff happens, I just say it, and it's always right. And then now that I've accepted it, it's getting more intense and it's getting stronger. And what I know what's going on is these dark forces don't want humans to go to the next level of real evolution, God's real evolution for us. And you hit the nail on the head.
Yes.
People see these fake churches. Well, Christ says in the New Testament, he spends the whole time criticizing the Pharisees and Sadducees and saying they pray in public, they act like they're God, they get in front of you in God. He's like, pray in private to God, open up your heart, the kingdom of heaven is with you. You're not God, but you are able to reach out directly, not through some priest, not through some preacher, but directly to God. It's great to go to church, get other people that are looking for God. There's a psychic connection. It boosts it. But the Satan is smart. He, one of the worst places is the churches, because that's where he lays the traps.
I think that's all true. And I just go back to what I said when we first sat down, which is, why have you been singled out for abuse and persecution? Why? I'm in the business of trying to figure out, usually unsuccessfully, but why things happen. It's not enough to say that they do. For me, anyway, my curiosity drives me to ask, like, why has this happened? What does this mean? What is this? And the fact that you, specifically you, Alex Jones, for the last 20 years, have been attacked in the way that you have been, even when you're on, like, cable access television, like a threat to nobody. Why did they single you out? And, of course, it's not because you're lying. In fact, had you lied and decided to make a career of lying, you would be a lot richer than you are, and no one would bother you. You'd be celebrated. You'd have a show on NBC. It's the fact that through you flows some things that are undeniably true. I mean, I can't vouch for all of it. I don't have your full, like, lifetime corpus in front of me, but I know that you predicted in detail 9/11 the summer before it happened. Like, that's just a fact. And I've thrown that out there many times. Like, okay, you may hate Alex Jones, but what is that? Like, what is that? What, honestly, like, how did that happen? Like, that's impossible. That's just it's, you know what I mean? So, like, why don't you tell me, Alex Jones hater, what are we looking at here? How could he have known that? And the answer, of course, is that you couldn't have known that, that's supernatural. Now, I'm not saying everything you say is like prophecy from God, but I'm saying that's supernatural because I can't think of a natural explanation. Maybe there is one. If there is, tell me what it is. But that's why they hate you. So that's revealing in itself. If you want to know, well, there it is right there. If July 25th, 2001, I lived in this country. I was in the news business on July 25th, 2001. I was an employee of the cable news network in Washington. I hosted a show for CNN. Trust me, we had every national security poobah on there, every retired CIA operative, some current CIA operatives, talking about this stuff all the time. Not one person came within a mile of what you said on some cable access show in Texas. Like, what? So that's the problem that they have, is that you blurt out these things that are true. And I just think if you want to understand what's actually going on, take a look at what makes the people in charge the angriest. What are the things you can't say? And that's a pretty reliable guide to what's actually happening.
No, I totally agree. So shifting gears away from me, what is it about Tucker Carlson that makes it so mad? Because you make a lot of predictions and accurate things, but you're even more strong. I mean, this is not an ass kissing contest. We're talking about why the enemy hates us, because that's important to understand. What are we doing that can beat them? If they're trying to stop us, we've got something that can defeat them. So everybody needs to understand this. We need to understand this. What is it about you? I think it's that you are definitely genuine, very smart, articulate, and are able to reach out across political lines and unify people. And all you're trying to do is save civilization and our future. They call you a hater. They call you an extremist, CNN and the usual suspects. Brian Stelter's mini-me. Oliver Darcy is running around trying to get Ticketmaster to pull and shut down your tour. I mean, why are they so scared of you?
I don't know if they are. It's funny, so many levels. But I would say, first, I don't have any kind of prophetic ability. I wish I did. Most of my predictions are wrong. Occasionally, I will get a really strong feeling about something, and those turn out to be right, but not that often. From the first day, I thought there was something wrong with the COVID vax, and I didn't know what it was. I still don't really know. But I felt that very, very strongly, and I went with my instinct on that. Second example of that is the day the war in Ukraine started, I had an overwhelming feeling that this is a really, really big deal. It's not some regional war in Eastern Europe. This is the thing that resets civilization and potentially ends it. I really felt that strongly. And I think that turned out to be true. But most of the time, I don't have that ability. Again, I wish I did. I've never called an election correctly. I always get them wrong. I think the reason they don't like me is because I'm from that world. I really do think that's offensive to them. I mean, I'm not some like mega insider or something, but I am actually from that world. I lived in D.C. for 35 years. I worked at CNN. I worked at MSNBC. I worked at PBS. I worked at ABC. I know everybody involved in that world. I know a lot of, you know, government officials. I was always a big booster of Washington. I didn't really criticize the system. I sort of believed in the system. I thought some things that you said were really dangerous and scary. I've apologized for that. Turns out you were right. I was wrong. But I really was kind of like, I had my views and I was conservative, but basically I was a defender of the system because I thought it was worth defending. And it was only 8 or 9 years ago that I realized, wait, this is really dishonest and wrong. And a lot of the things that they're telling me are the mirror image of the truth. They're not just incorrect. They're an inversion. They're the opposite of the truth. And
well, that's my next question, and elaborate, but before I forget it, so you talked about your spiritual awakening. What was your political awakening? So I remember like 12 years ago, you were going to come on the show, you'd attack me and stuff, which I understood. It was genuine. You know, you had real reasons for it, and I could get the things I was saying were so horrible that only a horrible person would say it when somebody is still projecting their own goodness onto things. So, but what was your, then, the last 12 years, your acceleration until now? I would say I watch your show every day when you do them, and I think you say things most of the time deeper than what anybody else is saying. It's true. So what was the process of your awakening?
Well, it's kind of hard to know because you don't see yourself clearly, and I am totally lacking self-awareness. I mean, I can gain 50 pounds and not know it until my pants don't fit. Like, I'm just not aware of myself very much. No, that's happened. it's hard really to know, but I, you know, living in Washington in the same neighborhood for years, and I mean, I got there in high school. So, I mean, I really did. I felt like I was part of the city and of its culture and life, and I did not feel like an outsider there. I felt like a part of it. And watching people I knew personally who I'd, you know, stood next to at soccer games, like at that level, lie and sort of, rather than defend what they were doing, attack the person who questioned it, I found that so low. That was so shocking to me, to watch smart people become that defensive about what they were doing, that it opened up a chain reaction in my head. I was like, well, wait a second. If they can't defend something as simple as NATO, right, they couldn't defend, like, why do we have NATO? What's the answer? If you ask that question, they'll immediately call you a racist or a transphobe or whatever. They'll try to, you know, attack your character rather than answer the question. And just as a man, I felt that was so disgusting. I mean, that's what children do. That's what drunk people do. That's what crazy people do. That's not what my Harvard-educated neighbors are supposed to be doing, who are running federal agencies. So when I saw that at the beginning of the Trump, it was really about Trump. I mean, it wasn't actually about Trump the man, you know, but it was about that moment in 2015-16. And I just thought, well, I have an obligation to see what I think is true and to keep pulling the thread. And that happened to be exactly the moment that I got a new job at Fox and had a bigger platform. And I just thought, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to have this, but I'm going to tell the truth, you know, with the knowledge I'm going to get it wrong often, which I, of course, do. But I'm not going to lie, period. I'm not going to lie. And let's just see where this goes. And the more, you know, the more I did try and tell the truth, just without any caveats at all, the bigger reaction I got, a negative reaction, like people really, really hated that. And then I just dug in and I thought to myself, I don't care what you do to me, actually. You know, my kids are grown. I just don't care at all. And I'm just going to say what I think is true. And then the next thing you know, I'm just like, I can't live there anymore. And everyone hates me and I feel sad about that. But I think if you're not because I actually had a million good friends in D.C. who were good people. I still think they're good people, but they've gone crazy.
But it wasn't like you were leaving one place for a worse place. I've been to your place in Maine. It's like it's like Valhalla.
Well, it's not a rich Valhalla, but it's more a working class Valhalla. No, it was our, you know, it's where I went in the summer anyway. So I thought,
I don't think it's Valhalla as palaces or Versailles. I think a Valhalla is big, beautiful mountains coming out of crystal clear lakes and rivers and trees. And
that's right.
And normal people.
We have a lot of that. And and I do think this is like not even relevant, but it's just true. I really like to hunt and fish and camp and be in the woods. And I've felt that way my entire life. Those are just important to me for some reason and always have been since I was a small child. And I think that made a huge difference. I think that if you appreciate nature, you don't have to be John Muir or, you know, live in a yurt. But I think being around animals and trees and water and granite and pine needles and, you know, just flowers.
That's God's cathedral.
Well, I feel that way. I feel that way so strongly. I feel that way overwhelmingly, actually. In fact, I have to restrain myself because I don't want to be boorish about it. But I feel and dogs also, I feel in a way that's hard to explain, but that those things are really important. I think God speaks to us through them. I think, but even message aside, they're such enduring sources of joy. I mean, that's so much more powerful and fulfilling for me to be in the woods with my dogs than it is to be sitting in front of a laptop, which I don't own, by the way. But if I did own a laptop and had to sit in front of it, I would still yearn to be outside. And I feel like that does center you. And you don't need to – we live in the middle of like a million-acre forest, but you don't have to. You know, you can go to the park. Anything that connects you with God's creation for just a moment every day – is every bit as important as going to the gym and getting your cardio or whatever they call it.
It's way more important.
It's like spiritually essential.
And you don't talk about yourself privately, but and I said, man, you ought to do a nature show because I know Ted Nugent well. He's a great shot. He's amazing. But you're a real outdoorsman. I mean, you're sharpening the chainsaw. You're building the houses. You're driving the boats around in the rivers and lakes. You're skinning the bucks and running the trot lines of the bears. I mean, I've been with you. You're like literally running around from hunting camp to hunting camp. Calling the show is a side deal. And I could see like this is a real outdoorsman, like my grandfather or something. I hope you do some outdoor shows because if people saw that side of you, they'd be blown away.
Well, I've always thought that cameras were corrupting. I mean, we didn't have.
That's you know, what I picked up. This is your real life. So that's like private.
Well, so I sort of feel, I sort of feel that way. I do think cameras are, I mean, the most intimate moments of your life should not be filmed. You know, the birth of your child, the conception of your child, you know, the best dinner party you ever had, you know, a drive with your son in the car where you talk about life. Like, these are not things that are, you know, being filmed for others. These are real moments that are lived out in real time and experienced, you know, as they happen, not in retrospect.
Well, that's what I said. I said, man, you're shooting these clays better than me and my military security detail, and we're good. And you're shooting bullseye. You're like Annie Oakley, but a guy.
Well, it's my range.
But I was like, you got to show people this. You go, no, don't videotape me. Don't videotape me doing this.
No.
I'm like, okay, John Wayne.
No, I don't. No, because you want it to be real. I mean, that is a prop. Look, I'll just say it out, out front. I am not for technology, and I think I go too far on that. I think it's almost like an eccentricity, but I don't like it, and I just don't like it. And that's how I feel. Technology makes my life possible. It makes my job possible. It feeds my children. I mean, there's a lot about technology that's good. I don't want to have to wash laundry by hand. I like washing machines. I mean, there are lots of things about technology that are good. But in my personal life, I really try to limit its use and limit the use of electricity. I just don't like it. That's how I feel. And
oh,
I can't
good.
Quite explain it. But no, I feel that way really, really strongly. And I just prefer to be in a place without it. If I can, most of the time I can't. I hear I'm talking to you on in some ISDN line, whatever that is. You know what I mean? But I think getting a respite from that is important because it restores perspective. And if you have the chance to, you know, use a candle instead of an electric light or use an outhouse instead of a flush toilet once in a while, I think it's good for you. I do think that.
And it's definitely
attacked
natural.
Attacked is Ted Kaczynski, but I like Ted Kaczynski. I'm just being, I do. And I don't believe in mail bombs. I don't believe in hurting people. I think Ted Kaczynski was insane, obviously, for doing that. But Ted Kaczynski's analysis of technology, even if you don't buy it completely, and I don't buy it completely, but it's worth hearing. It's worth thinking about. There should be some counterbalance to the propaganda from Google and the power company that we'd all be nothing without, you know, electricity and microchips. Like, that's not true, actually. That's a lie. And we should say it out loud. It's a lie. And I also think, honestly, that technology can be, while life-saving, you know, if my child had a medical problem, I would hope he went to a doctor, you know, who had access to electricity and machines and all that. It's great. But it can also be, this is just a fact, a vector for evil. Okay, that's just true. And somebody needs to say that. And I don't know why that's considered crazy or, you know, I don't know, radical to say that. I'm an incredibly moderate person. I'm a moderate person by my temperament. I don't like radical.
It's clear.
At all.
It's clear that we're way out of balance is what you're saying.
Way out of balance. Way out of balance. And I feel that way about so many things. I think people who, you know, you want to build a business, you have to take debt in order to expand the business. I get that. But the idea that we're sending credit cards to college students and hooking them on debt at 28% interest, and nobody knows the names of the credit card executives who are getting rich from the suffering of hundreds of millions of Americans, is shocking to me. Instead, we all hate Alex Jones because he's got naughty opinions. Really? What about the head of Citibank, who is hooking our entire country on credit cards and sending people into lifetime debt slavery? Oh, shut up. No, you shut up. You shut up. You're hooking people on debt. You're evil. And I think, why does no one say that? Like, we should have at least one person saying that. Maybe everyone else is on the side of finance, which is to say money lending. But maybe we should have one person who's like, nah, I'm not sure it's a good idea to be in debt to someone else, because then that person controls you and you're no longer free. Like, duh. You know what I mean? We are totally out of balance.
Tucker, you're 100% on target. I mean, when I'm immersed in cities and computers and work, I'm not happy. And when I'm in nature, I am in heaven, particularly in the desert or the woods somewhere where cell phones don't work. I just suddenly feel so calm, so good. It's amazing. So in the time we have left here, this is an incredible interview. I literally wrote 60-plus questions, and I've gotten about 10 of them. But let's shift gears back into one of the few questions I asked your crew for, because we don't like pre-program these interviews. But I said, what's something Tucker wants to talk about? Saving civilization, saving humanity. We've already kind of talked a lot about that. But specifically, let's speak to how do we stop World War III, and then the election, the lawfare, everything backfiring on the establishment. My concern is, what are they going to pull? Well, right on time, the bird flu. They're trying to relaunch that. Right on time, they're saying terrorists are about to attack them, but they open the borders up. Right on time, they're trying to accelerate the war with Russia. I mean, clearly, they're going to pull some October surprise. What do you think that is?
I don't know what it is. I mean, my instinct for 2 years has been that the war in Ukraine, the U.S. war against Russia, will change world history and certainly change American history and will have an effect on this election. I really think that's the biggest thing happening right now. And there are a lot of big things happening, but that's the only one with the potential to kill us all in the next 3 months. So I do think that will play a role in this election, because, of course, wartime gives government wartime powers. And those are very different from peacetime powers. Abraham Lincoln, who I think was a good man in a lot of ways, but became, of course, a dictator in the middle of the Civil War and suspended habeas corpus and detained people without charging them and et cetera, et cetera. So even, I think, you know, even decent men tend to become Winston Churchill, put the entire opposition party in prison with their wives for the duration of the Second World War. I don't think Churchill was the most evil man in history. I think that's an evil thing to do. And so even good people can become fascist during wartime and almost always do. So that's something to remember, I think. As to what we can do about it, well, we can do what we're doing, which is to try and tell the truth of that fear as clearly as we can, as thoughtfully as we can, as non-hysterically, as persuasively as we can. But I think the main thing that we can do is recognize our inability to really do anything, because we're not in charge, actually. And so what you can do is become a better person, a more virtuous person, and say your freaking prayers. I really believe that. I think that. Because at a certain point, like, countries get what they want. And if, you know, all of a sudden you wake up in a country where, you know, a lot of people are convinced it's more virtuous to abort a child than to have a child, if people are convinced that like war with Russia is somehow really important because Neville Chamberlain bad or whatever, you know, it's hard to stop that. It is. It's hard to stop that. And so you really need to appeal to a higher power because your power is limited. Like I tell myself this all the time, like something will happen. I'll get completely outraged. Oh, I got to talk about this. And then part of me says, you know, but don't fool yourself. Like talking about things is not in the end, you know, the same as like commanding an army or being God. Like you can't, your power is limited.
And for breaking news and updates, be sure and follow me at Real Alex Jones here on X.
The United States looks just like ancient Rome did in its final days. Of course, Rome didn't fall in a day, but when it finally received its death blow in 476 AD, its world power status had declined due to several corrosive reasons. Germanic tribes had beaten Roman forces into submission as Rome had overextended its military and its defense budget. Government corruption had reached epic proportions, and slave labor dried up, forcing the complacent, unskilled Romans to fend for themselves. Sound familiar?
Not many of us say to our sons and daughters, "I'm hoping the day will come when you decide to go and pick fruit for a living." Hardly ever hear that.
One of the most often made arguments with regard to immigration is that they only do jobs that Americans don't want. But in a recent analysis, we actually looked at all 474 occupations as defined by the Department of Commerce and found that there were only six that were majority immigrant, and those jobs only account for about 1% of the U.S. workforce.
But the final knife in Rome's back was that it lost its identity. Most importantly, Rome allowed the barbarian hordes to settle within its borders, which eventually led to an uprising, putting an end to the identity of a thousand-year-old world power civilization. Fast forward to 2021, and the United Nations has already decided for every citizen in the United States that over the next 50 years, you will need to be replaced by a foreign population.
As you know, the Secretary General has been concerned about this for a long time, and I'm very pleased that he's launched this program against xenophobia. If all of the migrants, recently arrived migrants in New York City, were to form a city, they'd probably be the third or fourth largest city in the United States.
As it reads from the United Nations' own website on replacement migration, United Nations projections indicate that over the next 50 years, the populations of virtually all countries will face population decline and population aging. The report considers replacement migration for eight low-fertility countries: France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Republic of Korea, Russian Federation, United Kingdom, and the United States. Ask yourself, do we really need the United Nations' help? During the baby boom following World War II, nearly 80 million babies were born, and for some reason we can't do that again?
Your child's school nearly doubled its enrollment.
The result? Classroom shortage.
There weren't enough classrooms and desks.
They gave my boy half a seat.
To give every student some kind of education, many schools had resorted to teaching kids in shifts.
Not too bad.
Students sat at their desks for just 2 hours and then went home.
Instead, bumbling, stumbling Joe Biden would have us all replaced in favor of a New World Order autocracy of which he is an acolyte and a puppet.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order.
His deceptive intentions are so transparent, a five-year-old can read between the lines.
I think this generation can be marked by the competition between democracies and autocracies. Because the world is changing so rapidly. The autocrats are betting on democracy not being able to generate the kind of unity needed to make decisions to get in that race.
Does anyone know who this person is?
Yes.
What is her name?
Maxwell.
Who is this person?
Maxwell. Is it the lady who got killed?
This is one of the sisters who got killed on Thursday. Anyone knows her name? Anyone knows what is her crime?
She was Christian, and she was.
Her crime is to be Christian.
It's nothing new. Christianity is under attack worldwide, from North Korea to Yemen to China to Somalia. Alarmingly, the persecution of Christians is exponentially getting more severe than ever. the number of Christians facing extreme levels of persecution for their faith rose from 245 million to 260 million last year in the top 50 countries on the World Watch List. Of the top 50, 45 countries have been designated extreme or very high in terms of the levels of persecution Christians face. That's five more countries than the previous year. Attacks against churches have risen 500%. On average, 13 Christians are killed every day because of their faith. And speaking of faith, overall, Americans' membership in houses of...
And so I think it's important to appeal to a higher power. If this is a spiritual war, and clearly it is, just on the, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I've just tried to contain it to like the logical unpacking of it. I don't see what else it could be other than a spiritual war.
Well, Tucker, I think you're being very healthy, being humble, but you are doing something about it. That's why they want to stop you. I think we have to understand that individually, you know, we can reach out to others, but I get your point. So looking at this, we saw January 6th, you've really been the tip of the spear exposing that it was a provocateur event. It's come out in Congress now. It's all been confirmed. That's January 6th puppet committee has destroyed all their evidence because it showed the truth that they were engineering at the new Pelosi video, admitting they basically had a stand down. They wouldn't let the National Guard out. I was there. We walked into a trap on that. And we saw Pelosi then with the military parades that she was, you know, they're inspecting and the barbed wire and all of these, you know, really fascistic, totalitarian things we saw. And now they're all over the news, as you know, saying they're training militias, right-wingers, terrorists. They're going to attack. They're pre-programming that. And just like with the fake Governor Whitmer kidnapping, I know, because they've done this before and they're telegraphing it, they're planning to try to trigger civil unrest that they build a civil war. They've got the movies out. They've got it all pre-programmed. That's another one of my big concerns. What's your view on that?
Well, that's so obviously true. I mean, one of the many binaries, I think, in life is male, female, masculine, feminine. And there are two ways of fighting and communicating. And they're very different. In fact, they're poles. They're the opposite of one another. One is direct. That's, of course, the masculine form. And the other is indirect. And that's the female form. And the Democratic Party is, of course, a female party. And that's how they fight. They fight by, you know, when they hit you in the face and scream, "Stop punching me! Stop punching me!"
That's exactly what they do.
A man fights. He says, "What'd you do? I'm going to kick your ass," and then does it. Of course. And so January 6th was sort of in keeping with the way they approached the world. It was a passive aggressive action. It was set this up, make it seem like the other guys are attacking, and then crush them. And so, of course, they don't change. That's who they are. They're feline, not canine. And they will do something very much like that, of course. But I don't think that that should deter people from saying what they think is true and being bold in doing that. And so, for example, Trump is being sentenced on July 11th, so a week before the Republican convention, and they may remand him. They may send him right to jail. How should he respond to that? I mean, there are two ways to respond. One is by, you know, doing what they say, doing a press conference from jail. They're persecuting me. The other way, and I can't recommend the better way, but there is another way, which is to say, no, this is completely legitimate. I'm not going to jail. This is a fake crime. You never would have indicted me for it if I hadn't been challenging your power. If I wasn't running for president, I wouldn't be sentenced to jail right now. That's just a fact. Everyone knows that's true. This whole process is a sham. I don't believe in your system. My ancestors created this system, and you've taken it over somehow and perverted it into something unrecognizable. And I'm not playing along. I'm not actually going to jail. So why don't you make me? And, you know, that is a way to approach it. And I would say that's the more direct way. Why play along with this stuff? What are you going to do about it? But in order to take that posture, you have to be ready to, to get hurt. You do. But I would argue that you have to be ready to get hurt whenever you tell the truth, you know, physically or in some other way. You know, you have to, you know, there's a risk involved. That's why everyone went and took the vax, because like they didn't want to take the vax. Many people didn't, but they're like, it's not worth dealing with the consequences.
So let me stop you. Let me stop you. This is incredible. Yeah. And I've been, you're right. I've been thinking about this. I've tried to be Gandhi-esque and have said, you know, never be violent in any way, offensively. But there comes a point with civil disobedience where if these are kangaroo courts, it's all been proven, And this is the other political party that's trying to take him off the ballot and been caught at every level, rigging these cases, and it's all blown up their face, where Trump then finally says, no, I'm staying here at Mar-a-Lago. This is a fraud. I'm not going. The problem is then the deep state stages terror attacks, blames Trump supporters for it. And so Trump currently saying, I don't mind going to jail. He's going to put himself in jail in Rikers Island. My concern is they might poison him or kill him. They're that desperate. So speak to that. And then clearly he has Secret Service because presidents are under threat. And political assassination goes on all the time. They just pumped a month ago five bullets in the Slovakian a president, Fico, and they're trying to kill the other leaders. I mean, this is what happens at the start of a major world war. So it's very paradoxical. So can you quantify? I don't think you're calling for either, you know, way, but
I'm not.
But you're just basically putting on the table what the options are of what's happening.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I have no idea what the right answer is. I'm, thank God, not facing a decision like that. Trump is. And I think he'll probably, if he's remanded to jail, he'll probably go to jail. I'm only saying at a certain point, it's important to acknowledge reality. And here's the reality. This is not justice. This is not a justice system. This is a husk of a system built by other people hundreds of years ago that has been taken over by new people who perverted its original intent. It's not real. It's fake.
It's
like
a
Harvard
coup.
University. Harvard University was the place where the smartest people in the country went. Now it's a place where you go based on your sex and your race. And the standards have been dropped dramatically. And the rest of us pretend that this zombie institution is the institution that we remember. And it's not. And it's just important to say that. I mean, in Zimbabwe, at the height of Mugabe's reign of terror against whites, he used the British, effectively Anglo justice system in place in Zimbabwe to crush the people whose ancestors built it. It wasn't a real system. It had bore no resemblance whatsoever to the system that had been in place before Mugabe got there, except, you know, the outward, you know, affectations are all the same. The judges still wore wigs. They still, you know, called the court to order with a gavel. But at its heart, it was a completely different thing. And, you know, you could argue about whether it's a better thing or a worse thing. I'm just noting
but
the obvious.
But that brings us to lawfare.
And I think it's important to say that.
It is. That brings us to lawfare. I mean, I've experienced it. It's not about me. I knew I was a beta test where I'm found guilty by two judges. Then they have show trials produced by HBO with the judges putting on makeup with scripts. And so I was there in a movie production. And to me, it wasn't about, oh, I feel sorry for myself. I was like, holy crap, we're in a lot of trouble. And then now we've seen it with Trump and everybody else and Steve Bannon and Navarro. I mean, imagine if they're able to steal the election again, what they're going to do. Because they've said on MSNBC, as you know, and everywhere, oh, we're going to not just go after Trump, all his supporters. And Biden put out in 2021 his national security directive, the main threat's white supremacy, that basically is almost non-existent when it comes to violence. And then he went on, as you know, to say, what is the definition of white supremacy? Questioning an election, questioning lockdowns, questioning open borders, questioning forced inoculations. So what do you imagine they're going to do if they're able to steal it again? What do you see unfolding there, and what will they do if they retain power in this societal coup?
Well, what won't they do? I mean, they're trying to put the front runner in the presidential race in prison for the rest of his life for things that are not crimes. So that just, I mean, that it answers its own question. Like, they will do anything. And I would expect that to continue. I mean, I do think the formality of these elections is really irksome to them. They hate the whole idea that people they despise would have a role in choosing the government or have any power whatsoever or be disobedient in any way. So they hate elections. The defenders of democracy hate above all democracy, of course. And so I think they will go very, very far in eliminating it. I do think that. And that's why I think that this election is potentially the last one. You know, real election, I think, to the extent it's even real. As to what we can do, I mean, look, I'll just tell you what I've resolved to do, which I'm not going to hurt anybody. I don't believe in hurting other people except in self-defense. And I really mean that. That's a religious precept for me, and I'm not going to change, period. So I'm not staging any kind of violent revolution against anybody, and I'm not going to. And I wouldn't recommend anyone else do it either. But I'm telling you what I've decided. But I'm going to tell the truth no matter what, period. I'm going to say it as loudly as I possibly can, recognizing the whole time that the consequences could be very severe. I mean, I know for a fact they could be, I've already dealt with this a little bit. and I mean, actual consequences, but that's just what it is. Like, what did you expect life was going to be about? Just ordering shit from Amazon? Like, this is what it is, actually. This is what it's always been. And we just grew up, or I'll speak for myself, I grew up in a world so insulated from reality. In 1985 America, it was just so rich, effectively unchallenged internationally, so stable domestically, that you never really had to face human nature. Well, now we do have to face human nature, and human nature is, you know, both good and bad, and there's certainly ugly parts of it. I mean, as you know, as in Jeremiah, it says, like, who knows the depravity of the human heart? Like, it's like they're capable. People are capable of anything their worst. And so just know that. It's all right. Just know that. And stop being so shocked by it. Like, would they kill people to take control of the world? Are you joking? Yeah. Who wouldn't?
Absolutely.
You know, people have always killed people to take control of the world. Right. So, like, you really do need to get out. I think it's easier for young people to get this because they didn't grow up in this country with the expectation that, you know, everything will always be great. I mean, that's the country that I grew up in. I think you did as well.
Normalcy bias.
You couldn't even imagine. Yeah, exactly. That's a nice way to put it. So just, like, know that. And if you're going to participate in it, speaking for myself, a nonviolent way, know that telling the truth, and you're a living example of this, is enough to get you killed. Just telling the truth is that offensive to the people in charge, because they're not just liars. Their currency is lies. They're about lies. The whole thing is a lie. And truth is the most offensive thing to them. So yeah, could you get killed? Absolutely, you could get killed. But maybe stop whining about it and do the right thing.
I was about to say the alternative.
I would much rather be killed telling the truth than I would, like, die of ALS or something. Like, we're all going to die in the end. I'm not on a suicide trip. I love my life, and I love my children and my wife and my friends and my dogs and the whole thing. But you are going to die, so you might as well be brave. That's how I feel about it.
And when you have that attitude, you have a vibrant, powerful civilization. But when you're always cowering to whoever's bullying you, then the worst bullies ascend to power. It was a famous interview with a newspaper of Thomas Jefferson. It's where the quote comes from, of all the evil men and tyrants need to flourish as good men do nothing. The newspaper interviewer said, well, what's the level that tyrants will go? And he said, whatever level you accept, because there's always one worse that will replace them. Tiger, we've been going for an hour. You've agreed to do about 25, 30 more minutes. Do you want to take a quick little break here and come back, or just keep going?
No, I'm totally good. I would just say, you know, part of it is, like, I don't think I'll ever figure out in my lifetime, till I'm dead, what went on, you know, over the past 10 years. It's too confusing, you know, and I don't think any person can fully understand the moment he's living in. But it does seem pretty clear to me that generational affluence has made America a lot weaker. I'm not for poverty. I'm not, you know, saying it's a good thing to not have enough to eat. I'm not.
But meritocracy has been murdered.
Well, meritocracy is long gone, but generational affluence is bad for families, and it's bad for countries. And I think one of the things we're seeing now is that people just feel like, just make the pain stop. I'm super, super comfortable. I don't want to be uncomfortable. And I get that. I feel the same way, by the way. I'm not judging anyone. I just want to be comfortable. I get it. But that's not sort of an option right now, actually. Being comfortable is not, you know, on the menu. You're going to be uncomfortable.
It's stagnant.
And yeah. And it's better to choose dignity, I think. It's better to be dignified about it. And what does that mean specifically? It means saying what you think is true, because you're not a slave. You're a human being. You're made by God, not the Biden administration. You have an inherent right to say what you think, to believe what you think, what you want. And the second someone tries to take that away from you, you know, you have a moral obligation to resist that. You have to. You don't have a choice. I mean, by the way, most days I would rather just sit in bed and eat French toast and read P.G. Woodhouse novels with my dogs. Okay. That's kind of my preferred, you know what I mean?
Sounds
day?
Good. No, believe
I'm
me.
Lazy and self-indulgent. No, I am. But that's just not a choice. We don't have that choice. So be a man about it. Don't lie to yourself. Am I going to go along with the deception and become something less than human? Or am I going to say, in a gentle, nonviolent, but persistent way, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not taking your COVID vax. I'm not going to pretend boys can become girls. I'm not going to, you know, mouth the slogans about Vladimir Putin and Zelensky that you're telling me to mouth. I'm just not going to do that. And there's nothing you can do to me that will make me do that.
That's beautiful, like, Tucker.
And including death, and I mean it.
So I've got a bunch of questions now I want to race through here with you. So since you talk about it, knowing Trump, and I've been the same. I've been mad at Trump. I've supported Trump. we're not zombies. We're not slaves. Yeah. So sometimes I hate him. Sometimes I love him. I've been public about that. They're like, why did Tucker say bad things? But he says good things. Well, it's a complex issue. Why do they hate Trump so much? And let's be completely honest. I know you're a nice guy, but I want your real critique of Trump. Why do they hate Trump so much? And also, who is Donald Trump?
Well, Trump is a really unusual person, an extraordinary person. You know, not all good, obviously, nobody is, but he's unusual. There aren't many people. I know a lot of people. My job is knowing people, talking to people. I haven't met anybody like Trump ever. Who is he really? I mean, you know, we'll know that when we die. You know, it's hard to know who people really are. And I should just say, I've been mad at Trump. I've said so. But my gut level affection for Trump is really strong. I just like Trump. I like talking to Trump. I like having dinner with Trump. He's just an appealing guy. So I should say that. But who is he really? I mean, that's these are deep waters. I don't, who am I really? God will judge that. But I would say they hate Trump for reasons that are not obvious. So if what they wanted was a certain policy outcome, you know, Trump is not very ideological. So like if the most important thing to permanent Washington was continuing to fund Zelensky, and that is very important to them, then they would just say, look, we're going to shut off all campaign donations and send you to prison until you agree to fund Ukraine forever. And Trump would probably say, okay, it's worth it. That's not what this is about. I mean, they want that, but that's not what it's about. They understand, and by they, I mean the bipartisan coalition that runs Washington and has for decades and has really run America into the ground and mismanaged the world to the point we're on the cusp of nuclear war. Okay, those people understand. They've kind of come to the end. They have no inherent credibility. They're not democratically elected. I think the last election was a sham. Even if it was real, the majority of the population does not support their program. So they don't have a democratic mandate, which is to say a legitimate mandate. In a democracy, legitimacy derives from the population. If most people don't support something, then it's not legitimate, right? Because it's a democracy. That simple. They don't have that. So they know they're illegitimate. They know that if they lose, they're going to face consequences to some extent. Probably not great consequences, let's be honest, but some consequences. But more to the point, when you are fragile, when you realize that people don't really support you, when you know that you are illegitimate, when you know you have committed criminal acts, and they have, a lot of them, then any chink in the armor is potentially fatal because you are weak. That's the truth. They are weak. Their empire is built on lies, purely on deception, and you can feel it when you deal with them. Weak people are fragile. It's the divorced mom with a hangover, like, shut up, shut up. Stop. Whereas, you know, the strong, sober dad is like, settle down a little bit. You know, it's okay. Right? Strong people are not hysterical. Weak people are hysterical. So their gut level understanding, and they're absolutely right. If I were running this, I'd say, just let the guy win. Why do you care? It's 4 years. It's a lot easier. You don't have to have all these fights. You don't have to go crazy or wreck the system. Let the guy win and then, you know, win again in 4 years. Or like, how about make a little bigger effort with working class whites? Like, why is that so hard?
And isn't that Trump's biggest success, Tucker, is that he's drawn out the deep state and made them?
Of course. Well, that is his success. But they can't allow him. I've only reached this conclusion recently because it's not obvious as a political analysis. Like, there are other ways to get what you want than what they're doing. But Trump as a symbol is deadly to them. If Trump is elected again, their whole system, like they fear that their whole system, and not just the government, but, you know, the spider web of NGOs and publicly traded businesses.
It emboldens the people. I mean, that's it. He's not out to get the people, even though he makes mistakes. He's pro-human, pro-populist. He went to Kim Jong-un and said, let's just build hotels and casinos. What's your problem? He wants success, and they don't. They're feudal controllers. They don't want that.
Well, I just think as a symbol, that you're absolutely right, but as a symbol, if he becomes president, what does it suggest? It suggests that their whole sort of empire of bullshit is like collapsing.
And they've said that in the Financial Times and Atlantic Monthly, which is their mouthpiece. They said if the populists get Trump in again, it's over because it emboldens the populist.
I think that's right. I mean, just imagine running what you describe as a constitutional republic or a democracy and waking up one morning and finding that your greatest fear is that the majority will get what it wants. Like, you would think like some self-awareness alarm would go off and be like, wait a second, isn't the whole point of this project to deliver to the majority what it wants because they own the government, not me? But it never seems to occur to them. Or maybe it doesn't. I don't know how they what they actually think. All I know is that they've decided that, and I think it's absurd. I think they would. I think permanent Washington could easily outlive another 4 years of Trump, just as it did the first 4 years of Trump. But they don't feel that way at all. And so they will do anything. And I would, and I've talked to Trump about this a number of times. He's not engaged with me on it. He's not stupid. Of course, he understands the threat.
But he won't respond on the assassination question, so you speak to it.
Well, not.
That's clearly the next move.
Right. Well, that's right. And by the way, I think it's a little bit too obvious to, you know, shoot people in a motorcade.
They'll poison him.
Do you know what I mean? 61 years later. Yeah. Or, you know, people, there are a lot of ways. I mean, you know, you do sort of wonder how Jack Ruby died of galloping cancer like a week before his second trial. Like, what was that?
You know, now they have weaponized cancer that'll kill you in 2 weeks.
By a CIA psychiatrist. You know, Jolly West visits him, and then next thing you know, oh, I've got terminal cancer. Oh, I'm dead in a week. Okay. So, you know, look, I don't know. I'm not a physician. I'm not a master of the dark arts. But I don't think like shooting people in public is you know, it's a little bit obvious at this point, but there are lots of ways that, like, honestly, if you think this is a spiritual war and you're not saying prayers every day, then you don't really think it's a spiritual war, do you? Right. And I obviously, so I really do think it's a spiritual war. I really do believe that. And these are physical manifestations of an age old conflict. I mean, literally age old since the beginning of time, this conflict has been playing out. And we have the privilege of knowing that. Like, this is kind of the last conclusion I ever thought I would come to in my life, growing up in a materialist, rational world in Southern California in the 70s and 80s. If you'd told me that by 55, I'd be like sitting talking to Alex Jones about how we're in a spiritual war, I would have been like, what? No, I don't think so. But it's just so obvious. And so I do think prayer plays a huge, huge role in this, like a pivotal role in it. And I hope people take that seriously.
Well, we do take it seriously. So we're at a major crossroads. To me, the dark forces spiritually manipulating and controlling these minions, these failures, these fallen clown show vassals who really are just spiritual puppets, they're scared of something coming. And if you study the Bible or you know, other ancient religions, they talk about not the fake liberal New Age stuff, but humans going next level. And I'm seeing a splitting away, people that get more into darkness, more dumbed down, or people really becoming more attuned, more connected, more aware. It's not just you and I or Joe Rogan waking up or Jimmy Dore or Russell Brand or everybody. And notice how all the popular people, despite censorship and attack, are people that are pro-human because humans are actually want that. It's like we're selling snow cones in hell.
Yes.
But at the same time, the system is rushing into control. I really feel they're scared of humanity reaching a zenith or a tipping point. What's your view on that?
Well, I mean, I think this is an attempt to extinguish humanity. You know, if you're a Christian, and I, you know, I can't speak for other religions, so I think this is kind of a commonly held belief among all world religions, or most anyway. But if you're a Christian, you believe that mankind, people, were created in God's image. We're not gods, but God created us in his image. So if your program is to oppose God, then by definition, you're going to want to kill all the people. So it makes sense theologically. It makes sense intuitively. And I sincerely believe that that is exactly what's happening. So how do you respond to it? Well, with bravery, without fear. Like, again, I don't know what everyone's so afraid of. It's so weird. I'm trying not to be judgy. I mean, there are things worth being afraid of, I guess. But telling the truth and standing firm in what you know to be true, there's no reason to fear that. Like, what's the worst thing? Like, if we're living in a totalitarian moment where the aim is to kill people, okay, you already know how it's going to end if you don't do anything. So why not just smile and tell the truth?
Many months later.
I mean, like, what's the worst that can happen? Well, what's going to happen anyway? But at least you retain your dignity. You know what I mean?
Oh, Tucker,
I just don't get it. Like, why is it so hard?
I totally agree with you. For me, the great part about being on Earth 30 years, you've 30 plus years, is the learning process of trying to tell the truth, trying to learn the truth, getting more and more accurate, still make mistakes. But for me, when I meet black, white, Hispanic, old, young, Asian, it doesn't matter, people that love liberty, that love freedom, they have electric eyes. And the children of those people have electric eyes like they did 20, 30 years ago. Everybody had those. There's like a soullessness in people now that aren't awake, that are disconnected. So to me, the journey is the destination. And to me, it's getting to meet all the really awake people. This is amazing. And then I get around globalists, not as much as you've been around over the years, but I've been to some of the events and I've had private meetings with them when they want to meet. And I met with some of the Bilderberg Group members, and Kissinger tried to get me 15 years ago to work for him, and did it in front of my producer. But I'm around them. They feel so unhappy and I feel an emptiness, but I'm around you and your wife and your dogs and your crew are around all, are just old men, people fishing at a pier. It is so real. It's so satisfying. I want to just defend it. I mean, do you get what I'm saying?
I know, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't say it before you did, that of you know, there's so much sadness in this moment watching all these things you love be destroyed. I'm almost over that, actually. I've accepted it. But what I didn't mention, and shame on me for not, is the upside of the moment, which is the people. I mean, you wind up meeting these people in so many cases. I had dinner last night or two nights ago in my barn with somebody, a well-known person, who I never in a million years thought I would ever have a meal with. And it turns out we had everything in common. And this is one of the people you described, an awake person who was not where he expected to be, reached conclusions he never thought he would reach. He's got opinions that were repugnant to him 10 years ago, as do I. And how beautiful is that? Because people like that are liberated from the burden of having to pretend. They don't, it's a huge burden to lie. It's a massive, I mean, all of us lie, you know, and if you caught me doing something terrible today, I probably would lie, you know, but it would be a huge burden. And once you feel like, well, I don't have to do that anymore, like there's no reason to do that, like, why would I do that? And I'm just not going to. Oh, you're just freer. Like, that is actual liberation. And that's why occasionally you meet people. I have met people in my life who've been in prison, for example, like actual, you know, prison, locked away, who are so free inside. I'm very anti-prison. For the record, I'm not, you know, encouraging prison. I hate prison, actually. But it is also true, and because I've known these people, that it's possible to lock a man in a concrete room with no windows, and he can be free anyway inside. Because it is an internal thing, actually. And when you meet someone who has reached that or is in the process of reaching it, it's just thrilling. You just want to be around people like that. So the bottom line is, my friendships are so much deeper now than they were 10 years ago. It's like no comparison. Like, I have conversations every single day with people that are so deep and rewarding for me, that make me feel so good, so connected to another person, which is the whole purpose of life. Break the veil, connect. I mean, that's what sex is, you know, connect with someone. But to do that just in conversation with people is thrilling. And it happens many times more often now than it did 10 years ago. 10 years ago, once a month, I'd be like, wow, I met this amazing person.
I was about to say, I swear to God, we're simpatico. I was going to say 10 years ago, it happened like once a month. Now it's all day long.
Yes, I have the same thing. Like, what is that? I don't know. But by the way, I don't need to know. I mean, I have lots of theories about it. The gathering of, you know, the sorting of society. I mean, clearly that is happening. But I don't even need to know. I'm just enjoying it. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like I get into bed at night and I've got two dogs under my arms. And it's like, I don't think a lot about what that means. I'm just like, I'm so happy. You know, it's like, it's a gut level animal joy that I experience when I really connect with someone in a real way. I think that is one of the main reasons that we're on this earth to do that.
Well, dogs are so honest. And I said this to my parents like 30 years ago. I said, dogs are like a psychic buffer. They're even more psychic than us. But they don't even have a mission except to love you and be part of the group. And it's unconditional love. Yes. I mean, you feel the love of a dog that loves you. And people that have really mean dogs, I go to their house and go, why does my dog suddenly love you? I said, well, I like him. I like her. So in the few minutes, 10 minutes we have left, Tucker, I think it's clear that we are at a major crossroads and inflection point, the biggest in human civilization that we know of. Maybe stuff happened before. We know our mainline history isn't true. And you talk about that. So speak about where you think we are in history, and then you've talked about the Nephilim that are in the Bible, and you're just, and I know the globalists, I know some of the elites, they're obsessed. You know, that's what the movie Prometheus is what they really believe. None of them are really atheists at the top. They believe that aliens put us here, that they're about to learn the secrets and become gods. But first, they've got to do the sacrifice and survival of the fittest. But you get criticized for that. We have all these UAVs that are doing, you know, Mach 100 and, you know, turning on perfect lines that, you know, none of our machines can do. There's a lot going on here. So just the infinite, to me, admitting there's an infinite makes these globalists even smaller when they try to have their big events and all their big fanfare. And the trumpets playing, they want us to believe they're everything. They're really nothing. So I've said a lot there, but we're at a crossroads. And you talk about what's in the Bible and the Sumerian text and all these other ancient texts around the world say the exact same thing. And I don't think they want us understanding that. But it's like they've gotten some order by some other group. Like the Bible says, the devil's marooned here, wants to kill us, kill, steal, and destroy until we actually carry out the real mission. And what we're about to do, like a caterpillar in a cocoon, about to come out and be a butterfly.
Well, I hope that's right. I mean, it does feel like we're moving toward, you know, toward some resolution of a longstanding problem. But you know, that may not be the case. You can't. Why? Well, let me just say, parenthetically, I adamantly agree with your point that our understanding of history is not supported by the archaeological or geologic record. Okay. It's just fake. I'm not sure what the truth is, but clearly the story we were told is not true. So there's that.
By the way, interrupt real quick. Did you know the WEF is running around the world suppressing hundreds of archaeological digs with the UN right now, where they're now saying the environmental thing to do is not dig up this. Why don't you just said it, but why don't they want this dug up? But I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I didn't know that, but that's absolutely perfect. There has been, you know, it just tells you a lot. There's been an extraordinary effort on the part of various authorities over the last 100 or so years to suppress and distort archaeology and now DNA testing. And I find that really interesting. Why do they care, actually? Why would you care what we learn about the world 2 or 3,000, 5,000 years ago? Why is that a threat to you? But it is. In the same sense that all government propaganda about UAPs, UFOs, has one point, and that's to deny the existence of the supernatural. Well, why is that? You know, that's the message. If there's one message from the propaganda, from the various federal agencies and journalism companies involved in lying about UAPs, it's the supernatural is not real. Why do they want us to believe that? I don't know. but it's very revealing. The lies themselves are always the key to the truth. Like what do all of their lies have in common? What's the message here? What do they want me to believe? And you're probably not going to go broke betting on the opposite being true, I would say. As for where we are in history, it's unknowable. And if you're a Christian, you will notice in all the prophetic apocalyptic writings in the Bible, which I've read, there is consistently a warning to people reading these, like, you don't know, actually. And the end of history comes, I think I'm quoting, like a thief in the night. Like, you don't know. If you knew, like, you would have probably a different response. So I think it's important to go into this question on, as all questions, with the knowledge of your limitations. You know, like, you're probably not going to figure out when the end of history is coming. But clearly, we're in the middle of a pivot. Like, clearly. And clearly, the stakes are bigger than like who runs the executive branch of government, like way bigger than that. They're the future of the world. The last thing I will say is I think it's really important to understand what they hate most of all. They hate a lot of different things. They hate working class whites. They hate tobacco. You know what I mean? They hate testosterone. You know, they have a lot of hates. These are hateful people. They're haters. But the thing they hate most above all else is Christianity. Not all religions, Christianity. That's what they hate. But why is that exactly? Why is Christianity, which is the world's only nonviolent religion, like really, certainly it's the world's biggest religion, and it is officially nonviolent. Turn the other cheek. Someone takes your cloak, give them your shirt. That's the religion. It's the religion of peace. That's the threat? Like, why is that? You know, in other words, if I'm like a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Zoroastrian, it doesn't matter what my religion is. I'm running a country. I want a country full of Christians because they're civic-minded. I know for a fact they're not going to foment bloody revolution against me because their religion tells them not to. They're peaceful. They're hardworking. They stay married. Like, they're not out doing crazy things. Like, I want Christians. That would be the logical, obviously the logical conclusion, right? Because they're just They're orderly
and
people.
And why would you be against that?
Religion.
Why would you be against that?
Not just against it. It's the thing that they hate most. It's the thing they're most threatened by. It's the thing that they seek to destroy. And you have to just ask, like, why? That's not rational. There's no sort of policy goal that's served by opposing Christianity.
It's spiritual.
There's only a spiritual goal that is served by opposing Christianity.
All right. In closing,
that's just a fact.
In closing, you're the master at ever plugging all the great things you're doing, your show, your network, the great live events you're doing. We're going to do that in a moment. But since we bring this up, Elon Musk, I judge a tree by its fruits, as Christ said. And Musk is involved in all the big, you know, high tech things that you know, could have Trojan horses and issues. But I see him pivoting from being, you know, moderately globalist to at the World Government Forum last year saying world government's bad, it's tyranny, we're against it. I see him boosting free speech. I see him attacked by all these governments from Australia to Brazil to the EU trying to arrest him. And I see him reaching 100. The only thing bigger than Tucker Carlson, it goes Elon Musk, Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan, and then like Alex Jones, a bunch of people, which is great. I don't want to be number one. I love seeing people more articulate than me. And, you know, that means we're winning. But you're like right below Elon Musk. You're the most, it's true, the second most influential person in the world in thought today, even above Joe Rogan. It's not a contest. It's just you have to recognize it. Is Tucker Carlson, with all the choices you've made, the things you've done, and you're a humble man. That's why God's given you this power. But we're there, Elon Musk, because I cannot bitch at a gift horse. I cannot look at somebody where I'm reaching 10, 15 million people a day on X and I'm not being censored and the real me can be seen. And then like, well, he's doing this, he's doing that. But you know, Elon, give us a few minutes on Elon Musk, because I think he needs to be protected and defended. He's in a lot of danger. He's really stuck his neck out there. And I think we're idiots if we don't back him.
Well, I think the first thing you said is the truest thing. Judge a tree by its fruits. You know, anyone who's not against me is for me. And look, I kind of gave up here. I've been talking about motives and what motivates people. The truth is it's pretty hard to know. I don't even understand my own motives a lot of the time. I act on instinct.
Action matters. Action matters. My grandfather used to tell my dad, I don't want to hear talk. I want to see action.
Well, and if I'm trying to judge someone, I judge him by his actions. Stop telling me you're a great person. Show me whom you've helped. Like, it's kind of that simple for me. And I think Elon has done an extraordinary thing by opening up X to, you know, greater speech, freer speech. I mean, it's just extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And you notice it immediately in the downstream effects are super obvious. People are less afraid to say what they think is true as compared to last year, certainly as compared to 3 years ago, when people literally couldn't even ask, like, I have a friend who's injured by the vax. I'm afraid to say that? Really? A medicine that you forced me to take hurt me, and I'm too afraid to say that out loud. Like, that's a crazy level of fear. And I feel like that has really evaporated. And I think Elon Musk is the main reason. Opening up X for people to, you know, have unauthorized thoughts like that, it just frees everybody.
It's revolutionary.
It's an inspiration. In the same way the United States was an inspiration to the world for 100 years post-World War I, because we had liberal democracy and market capitalism, and it seemed to kind of work. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, I don't want to just buy the Coca-Cola and the Levi's. I want the system that produced the Coca-Cola and the Levi's. We didn't even need a State Department or a USIA to make that case. People just watched and they're like, yeah, that works. I want it. And I think that freedom of speech and creativity are exactly the same. You know, I don't want to hear a lecture about creativity. If I look at you and I'm like, that person is a free thinker who's creative, and that's joyful and productive and great. In fact, it's holy, which it is. Then I want some of that. It inspires me. It gives
exactly.
me heart, courage. Yeah. So,
well, it's so a in big closing, deal what he's talking done. About Elon. He's putting out the actuaries and numbers about the collapse of the Western world, people not having children. The globalists are the opposite. They're saying humans are over. There's no human future. Yuval Noah Harari, Klaus Schwab, Bill Gates. He is directly saying to them, you're going to destroy civilization and you're going to destroy yourself in the process. We must stop you. He has, whatever reason he did it, he's made the decision to pivot to pro-humanity. He agreed with me. I said, we should call this Team Humanity. He said, yeah, let's call this Team Humanity in an interview I did with him. That is so profound. That is so powerful. Tucker, I know you've been very gracious. You've got more to do today. You've given us an hour and a half. In closing, because you're the master of everything except promoting the great work you're doing, and I think if you got behind promoting yourself, and I'm not criticizing, it'd be even bigger. Tell us about your show. Tell us about your TuckerCarlson.com. Tell us about the speaking tour, because these are like mini Trump rallies, which are going to be bigger than his in many cases, because they're trying to put him in jail. He could be in jail coming up in September and October and November when you've got this big tour. I know you're adding dates all the time, and I'm going to be involved in some. Well, we'll just leave it at that. I'm so honored to be there. But these are important free speech rituals that the enemy is so upset about. So please tell us a few minutes about everything Tucker Carlson, the Tucker Carlson Network, and how everybody needs to not just say, oh, Tucker's so big, he's got it handled. No, we need to magnify what you're doing.
I said, sure, I'd be happy to, but actually it pains me. Can I say one thing about...
Yeah, why won't you talk about yourself? Go ahead.
I will, because I'm a WASP. I hate this. It's like getting a prostate exam for me. I talk about myself, but let me just say that's kind of the nub of everything, Elon's point about birth rates, because it is, once again, a binary. You're either the sort of person who dreams about killing, extinguishing life, or the kind of person who dreams about creating life. I mean, it's really a very simple choice. And if you're not reproducing, then you're dying. And the idea of embracing that is so unnatural, so grotesque. I mean, there's nothing greater. Everyone's supposedly obsessed with sex. Well, what is sex? It's the beginning of the creation of life. That's why we're driven to do it. Because there's nothing greater, there's nothing more fulfilling, there's nothing more inherently meaningful than creating life or being present when God creates it through the act of sex. Like, it's the greatest thing that there is. And then children, of course, are part of you. And there's no greater achievement than having children, and there's no more enduring joy than having
children. It's beyond magic. So you and a woman you love have great pleasure and interface, and then merge your genetics to create this wonderful new creature that is it's freaking everything. I mean, God is there. You see the perfection.
Unbelievable. Yes, exactly. God is there. So, you know, you find people who don't have a chance to have children or don't realize its importance until it's too late. I mean, that's always the case. Or the society is, you know, having
and the left's so mad they don't have kids, they want to take it away from us. Notice those that don't have kids form the core of the globalist death cult because they're pissed they didn't have it. They want to take it away.
But they're literally, it's more than just like some people don't have kids. It's like they're promoting not having kids by promoting, you know, the LGBTQ three spirit agenda. Of course, that's what that is. It's not about tolerating people who are different, which almost every American is just instinctively happy to do, very much including me. No, it's promoting childlessness. It's the end of family, the end of children, the end of reproduction, the end of humanity. It's anti-life. And the opposite of that is pro-life, not just opposing abortion, which you should do because it's killing, but more broadly, I'm for reproduction. I'm for babies. And I just think it's kind of that clear. And if you find yourself on the side that's against people, against babies, against reproducing, against reproductive sex, against joy, human connection, like you're on the wrong side, actually. And there's sort of no arguing it. Okay, I'll stop. As to what I'm doing, everything to me is about getting what I believe out there, disseminating a message, what I think is true. If it's false, of course, I'll correct, which I have many times. It's not like I have a monopoly on truth, but I really believe what I say, and I want people to hear it if they want to. I want them to have the chance to do that. So censorship is the single biggest obstacle, not simply to my job, but to human freedom and flourishing. I really believe that. So everything we do is designed to get around the censors. Watching what's happening to you right now actually affects my sleep because I think it's the worst thing. It's the beginning of enslavement of our country. So anyway, I've done two things to get around censorship. One is to build a subscription service that is not dependent on advertising. It's tuckercarlson.com. You subscribe. And so our audience pays not very much, but they pay for what they get. They support our business. So we cannot have the legs kicked out from under us by some advertiser. Toyota can't call up and be like, oh my gosh, you questioned January 6th. We're pulling our ads. And then you have to fire everybody. I've lived in that world for 30 years. I'm never doing that.
So again. It gives you total independence. Insulated. And they're like missionaries backing you, like families of fund missionaries to go out and then reach hundreds of millions of people.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's like, though. I don't, you know, I'm not going to redeem anyone's soul, but I'm going to try to tell the truth my absolute hardest no matter what. Okay, so there's that. Second thing we're doing this fall is taking it on the road in live events. You can't, you know, Google has no control over a stadium speech. They can't rearrange the search results when you're speaking live on stage to people who paid a ticket to be there. Now, you do have problems with venues that come under enormous pressure. CNN is trying to shut down this tour, which is crazy. When I worked at CNN 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it was pretended to be a news organization. They weren't in the business of preventing people from getting information, but now, of course, that's their only mission. But anyway, I don't think it's going to work. And by the way, if every single venue pulls out because CNN demands it because I question the vax or something, then we'll just do it in a field with loudspeakers. I'm doing it.
And we're gonna I love go
across
it.
The, I mean it. I mean it, too. If we have to get a tent or stand in the rain and yell, I will do it. And we're doing it from California to the East Coast, from New York to California and everywhere in between the entire month of September, probably some of October. We've got 15 dates, probably doing more. The tickets have, all the pre-sales are gone. I think they go on sale tomorrow-ish. But sales are great, so I think we're going to add more. And then, and every city, you know, bring someone, including you. I'm grateful that you're doing it. Russell Brand, you know, every people who you know and take seriously and love in some cases will be coming up and on stage at every event. And I think it's going to be amazing. And last thing I'll say, and I will stop now because I can't stop talking once I get going, is I want to see America. Like I'm from here. I grew up here. I was born here. I'm never leaving here. It's the only passport I have. And I think the physical country matters. I don't like all this America's an idea. Really? No. Ideas can be changed in a generation. You know what can't be changed in a generation? The Rocky Mountains, the Great Plains, the forests of Northern New England. Like, I want to see the country.
Oh, the globalists are at war with rural people and the forgotten people, and they love you, and you're going to bring. And I love the fact that, because they're desperate to shut this down, because this is going to be like a whole nother Trump campaign, but with an even, I'm not putting Trump down, an even better speaker. And hey, I'm so blessed to be involved in the dates. Anything you want, your crew's like, oh, thanks for agreeing to come. I'm like, are you, thanks for agreeing? I mean,
it's going to be so fun. It's going to be so fun. And then you get, I mean, everyone always talks about America, America, America. Well, let's go see America. I'm serious. Like, let's go to 20 states and see how people are doing. Like, what does it look like? You know, that matters to me. Physical reality matters to me. It's why I love nature. It's why I love animals. It's why I love my wife. These aren't ideas. These are things. These are living things. And I want to see the living thing that is America and the 350 million people who live here. I want to know. Do you know what I mean? I'm sick of all the theories. I want to smell the reality.
Exactly. Not just smell the coffee, smell the reality. Tucker, thank you for the time. We love you. We appreciate you. Can't wait to see you on the road. We'll be watching you. We're trying to stop World War III. Thank you so much, and God bless you for the time.
God bless. Thank you. Good luck, man.
Don't hang up, Tucker. If this is over, I want to say bye to you. Folks, incredible interview. Share it everywhere. Go get your tickets now. It's already selling out. This is so exciting. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Well, I'm very excited about this interview, and so is my wife. Everybody loves Russell Brand. So we got 45 minutes with him doing his show after we just aired the Tucker Carlson mega insane bombshell. And the dessert is Russell Brand. Two great titans of liberty, really authentic, real people reaching tens of millions of people a day. So, Russell, in the time we have, I like to talk. I'm going to really try to let you talk this time instead of me talking about the state of the world right now, the censorship, the attacks, World War III, how we turn this around, the Great Awakening. I mean, it's so paradoxical. All the top talk show hosts in the world now are anti-globalist, pro-human, which is simple. Humans want freedom. That's not a not rocket science. And you've got Elon Musk and just everything. So up there in the panopticon, you know, in the constellations of leaders fighting tyranny, it's Tucker Carlson and Joe Rogan and Russell Brand and Elon Musk up there as the North Star. Say what you want, but the proof's in the pudding. This is an amazing time. So thanks for being here. I want you to have the floor as much as possible because I love to talk. And just first of all, you say, how would you describe your life's journey and then where we are today?
First part of life is about trying to escape from the conditions of birth, recognizing that there are material restrictions, and then feeling that maybe social and cultural roots will provide a solution. You know, maybe if I become a star, if I have material means, if I can get myself to Hollywood, if I can become a stand-up comedian, if those things play out for me, maybe I'll be okay. But all the while, as a drug addict, first of all, and then a recovering drug addict, recognizing there has to be a greater spiritual solution. And because I'm a drug addict in recovery, and because I'm from an ordinary background there in the UK, recognizing that there seem to be these systems of authority and control that you have to navigate and negotiate and deal with, even if these are simple little things like school and law and order, and that they claim moral and ethical supremacy, but you see that perhaps they're being controlled by other ulterior or somehow transcendent systems. Then, you know, for a minute, the hedonism is enough, the drugs are enough, the promiscuity and the access to favors and delights and pleasures and distractions and prestige are enough. But because of that sort of spiritual yearning that any recovery drug addict or alcoholic will know, any seeker will know, there's a kind of sense that this is not it. This was never it. Of course, success, personal individual success, is never going to be enough. All the while, amidst this, I'm still occupying peripheral spaces as a person in recovery. I'm still educating myself with people like you and David Icke, listening to renegade voices, reading esoteric books, looking at credible academic sources, as well as people like you that suffer smears and condemnation and attacks that aren't perfect, that make mistakes, don't we all, damn it? And starting to aggregate and accumulate and curate my own purview that's like, hey, there's some sort of, there's a radical movement available. There's a radical movement available if you're brave enough to participate. I held up Bill Hicks's book for a moment while you were talking, not just because of the ongoing conspiracy theories that you are the risen ghost of Bill Hicks, but because he's such a great American voice, such a brilliant comedian, such an important and vital radical, such a brilliant evangelist and preacher. So first, poverty. Second, infatuation with materialism. And finally, ultimately, very slowly, like the dumb person I surely must be, the recognition, acknowledgement, and awakening to the fact that if you are not able to tackle personal attachment, personal egotism, personal longing, then you cannot be a servant of the many available causes, but the one ultimate cause, our vital fight for free speech, our vital fight for personal sovereignty, our vital fight to be able to create a marketplace of ideas that isn't brokered by bureaucratic forces that claim that they're there to help you, that ultimately seem to be there to control you. Thank you for the great work that you have done, Alex Jones, and the personal price that you have paid in ensuring that these spaces continue to exist.
Russell, what I think you say is key. You've come from nowhere but a top Hollywood star, huge comedian, done everything, and now you're turning, you've been turning for years against it. That's a message to people that feel like they can not only get success in the system. I think what I'm getting is you're saying the system is broken and it's gone, and now it's the exodus out of the system, and there's that kind of wild, you know, move away from it. But I think it's that process, though it's helter-skelter, that's going to take us to the next level.
That's right. The system will ultimately choke you. The system will only favor you, adorn you, and celebrate you as long as it can utilize and exploit you. For a moment, it's easy. Any person with an ego will think, wow, my success is based on the fact that I'm fantastic in some way. But it was a friend of mine who said that when you see yourself on a billboard on Sunset Boulevard promoting a movie and you see your name up in lights, you think for a moment you must be some real hot shit. Then you realize it's just the inadvertent side effect of someone else making money from you. You can temporarily be deployed as a unit or as a useful idiot, or pick a term, as someone that's useful to a particular agenda and particular set of objectives. Now that we have the ability to communicate and expose and convey counter narratives, it's getting harder and harder for them to centralize control as more and more diffuse systems of communication become available. The natural tendency is towards individual freedom and community freedom. The new elites don't know how to tackle and control this yet. So they're inventing new laws around censorship, new ability to surveil, new bureaucratic means to shut people down and control them, because the flow of power is towards maximum freedom. Freedom is our natural environment. With personal freedom and respect for the freedom of others, you don't need the amount of bureaucratic intervention. It seems to me that what we're living through now, as all of us begin to recognize that you can't trust the media, you can't trust the judiciary, you cannot trust the state, you cannot trust the big corporations nor the bodies that are supposed to regulate them, you cannot trust the law itself because it is not derived from holy principles, it is derived from materialistic endeavor and a desire to control and subjugate. As people realize this, as people communicate communicate. You know, any one of the voices that you've listed now, people will say, oh, Jordan Peterson, he's controlled opposition. Alex Jones is controlled opposition. Russell Brand is controlled opposition. Tucker's controlled opposition. But sooner or later, we're going to have to recognize that there are new and unique alliances potentially emerging that collectively can oppose a significant centralized threat when it comes to the control of information, but a threat that is being countenanced, is being opposed. We are pushing back.
No, you just hit the nail on the head. I know I'm real, and I'm honored to be compared to Bill Hicks, but I have nothing to do with Bill Hicks. But I'm honored. But you're absolutely right. People don't believe in victory because they've been demoralized. The fact that freedom is so popular, like take Elon Musk. Headline, Elon Musk had sex with an employee consensually. Who cares? Did he launch a war and kill 10 million people? Did he start World War III? Did he put HIV and hepatitis in the Bayer Factor 8 product? No, he didn't. Who cares if Elon Musk had a consensual relationship with an employee and said, I want to have a baby with you? I mean, it's like a beautiful story. Oh, my God, he's not married. He has sex with an employee and says, I want to marry him, a baby. Give the guy a freaking medal. So the idea is they're attacking people that are following the basic human programming, like they tried on you to make you bow. In the last 6 months, it was all made up. It was all a lie. But that's what they do. And it shows how desperate they are. You can have drag queen pedophile time with convicted pedophiles with kids sitting on their laps at libraries. That's fine. You can have fentanyl, hundreds of thousands of deaths. You can have open borders, sex trafficking. That's all fine. But, oh, my God, women like Russell Brand or Elon Musk had a girlfriend consensually. It's not working, though. It's not having an effect now.
Viva Fry, who's a fellow contributor on Rumble, yesterday gave me this great quote from a legal expert. Show me the man and I'll show you the lawsuit. And this makes so much sense to me. Now, as a Christian, as a person that's pursuing a spiritual path, I can recognize that ethically and morally, my selfish, promiscuous sexual conduct was reckless and foolish. But God, at the time, it was celebrated. It was certainly consensual. People, like the part of being a Hollywood star and a comedian who's announcing on stage, hey, if you want to have sex with me, come backstage, is that there are a lot of people, well, you know, in my case as a heterosexual man, women that are well up for that. It was unbelievable. I grew up as a pudgy little chubby kid, a nervous, shy little boy in Grays in Essex, full of doubt. So suddenly to become a big star and have access to all that early in recovery from drugs and addiction is the most exciting thing in the world. Pretty quickly, if you've got anything about you spiritually, you'll start to recognize, this isn't right, is it, to live like this?
And you'd suddenly already gotten, exactly. I was the same way, not at your level, but up there. It was empty. And I got a family, got married, it all stopped. But the idea that you with consensual sex is a great crime, while the UN running giant sex slavery and Jeffrey Epstein, notice how they hold that up as, oh, Russell Brand and Alex Jones, and oh my God, you know, Trump cheated on his wife, he's a devil. Well, his wife didn't leave him, they worked it out. That's not a crime against humanity. That's normal human behavior. We could have done better, but the idea that they hold us out as the devil is a fraud. The real devil's starting World War III. The real devil's putting poison shots in our arms. It's not Russell Brand. Women love him, and he's just, I'm sorry, it's not a crime.
It's pretty extraordinary, but again, to that quote, you know, show me the man and I'll show you the lawsuit. If you've spent a long time having promiscuous sex with strangers, you're obviously creating a terrain of vulnerability. And again, from a spiritual perspective, of course I should have done better as a man. Of course my job here is to help people find their own way to connection. And if not purity, then at least some kind of salvation. At least I could be useful. At least I could be here helping people. And that's not how I was living. I was living selfishly.
Yeah, but you didn't kill millions in Iraq cutting their food off, so you shouldn't apologize.
Well, no, I did do that. I claimed that there were weapons of mass destruction. And then what I did is I marshaled the world's armies into a war that created a mass terrorist response. And then that very same system that we use over there in Iraq, I deployed that domestically against the British population and the American population. And I created the Five Eyes movement, where so that we could transgress national laws on surveillance and privacy, I was able to make sure that Australia spied on British people and New Zealand spied on American people, and we all exchanged the info. Oh, no, that wasn't me. That's the systems of power that we're trying to oppose. You know, what I suppose I reject most strongly, Alex, is the idea that these systems of dominion and damnation care about people. They're always saying, like, you know, we have to protect you from misinformation. We have to protect you from malinformation. We have to protect you from Alex Jones or Tucker Carlson. You have to protect you from Joe Rogan's going to make you take the wrong medicine. Tucker Carlson's going to make you believe the wrong thing. Alex Jones has erred in some way. I don't believe that they care about ordinary people. I believe they care about centralized authority, and anyone that is a threat, no matter how minor or how major, will be smeared, will be shut down.
And Russell,
they will find a way to control you.
And I totally agree. And I'm not here lecturing you. I just watch your show. My wife watches it. We watch this every day. It comes out like 3 or 4 days a week. We watch you. And you're always apologizing. You didn't do anything. You're a famous movie star. Women wanted you. Let's move on. You did not launch war crimes. You did not lie about WMDs. You did not kill millions of people. I want to play this clip because I was the same way 7, 8 years ago. They would attack me, and I'm trying to be reasonable. I'm not perfect because we're not arrogant. Yeah, you're right. They would then use that against me. Just move on. They're the criminals. Here's Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes. 2 years into the Clinton administration, they killed 2 million by the end of it, half of them kids. It was 1 million then, half of them kids. So she says, I would do it again. Here she is killing 500,000 children, cutting off food and medicine, and then Russell Brand is the bad guy. It's not about kissing Russell Brand's ass. Russell Brand didn't kill anybody. Russell Brand's not bad. The globalists are bad. Here it is.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
And she goes on to say she'd do it again. So let's move on. You didn't kill 1 million kids, 500,000 at the time. So let's talk about the real guilty, Fauci. The whole thing is collapsing. All the studies, mass death, down 35 million dead from the shots. Where does Russell Brand, a smart guy, think this is all going? Because the system is collapsing. What do you think they're going to pull, and what comes out of this?
Firstly, can I just ask you, do you think that it is 35 million people have died from various vaccine or gene therapy related injuries? Do you think that's the number, Alex?
Yeah, the numbers only come out a year later, so... They're always a year late. That's how the insurance company actuaries work. So by 2022, it was 10 million. By 2023, the number came up from the year before, 2022, it was 22 million. And yeah, the new numbers are 35 million dead. I mean, they admit 40% overall global all-cause mortality increase of death, 35 million. So yeah, 35 million conservatively dead.
And you're basing that on, that's the number of excess deaths. There's no other explanation. There's been no other mass event. And with everything we're learning about turbo cancers and various heart conditions and various other neurological conditions and the observable impact on children and some of the reported yellow card events, this is a conservative, maybe.
Yeah, but let's just change the subject. You were a rock star and had a bunch of women. That's what matters. Let's just talk about that.
Yeah, I feel you. And like, what I feel like is over time, incrementally, we are able to observe the position at the commencement of the pandemic, and we were able to observe where we are now, the sort of slow release of information. Oh, okay, it was a lab leak. Okay, there was research that the EcoHealth Alliance were participating in. Yes, the NIH were involved in that funding. There were distinct batches. Yeah, like there was investment from this group and that group. This medication was patented. Slowly, you start to realize, and this is a device I use on my show, is I say that we're closer to the Alex Jones prognosis than the BBC prognosis, even by what's being acknowledged in legacy media outlets when it comes to the distinction from what they were saying at the beginning to what they're saying now. So plainly, this was an extraordinary event. I'd love to ask you, do you think it was a unique event in so much as that they would make taking unique actions, or was it unique because we were able over a short time frame to see how these institutions work together? Was it a unique event in terms of its scale, or just our ability to observe?
I mean, I think it's both. If you read the Rockefeller Foundation, Lockstep, 2011, and you read all the rest of the stuff, they said, we're going to use a virus to take control. And so this was their play. It was all on purpose. It wasn't a mistake. I see Congress like, Fauci, admit you made a mistake. I didn't make a mistake. I did not make a mistake. No, it was not a mistake. It was a premeditated power grab for depopulation to corrupt the medical system and get full control. So if tyrants are going to make a move, it's going to be the medical system. So they did it. So now it's blown up in their face. And now they're trying to bring back bird flu. So the next question is, how do we counter their next operation? We're all vindicated. And it's not about, oh, I'm vindicated, aren't I great? No, it's about stopping the next event. So you've been through hell exposing the truth. So has Joe Rogan. So has Tucker Carlson. All of us, all the listeners and viewers. And so the bigger debate is, wow, the globalists aren't invincible. They're not. They're tyrants that believe they were. The bigger question is, what are they going to pull next? And then what is the right course of action to take control of the system and then stop them from the next attack? That's where I'm at.
I suppose the next attack is likely to be an escalation of hostility between Western powers and Russia, potentially all-out war. Or there will be some regulation imposed because of climate change, or there will be some kind of new pandemic. I suppose what we can assume is that crisis in conjunction with the ability to impose regulation appears to be the template. What's weird about this, Alex, I think, is 20 years ago, 30 years ago, before this space became so mercurial and volatile, this would have been an analytic you would have got from Noam Chomsky or Naomi Klein in shock doctrine, the way that the CIA and various deep state forces would create coups and opportunity for power grabs in South and Latin American countries. We're now just seeing deployed domestically in the same way that some of the methods and technology that's been used in Middle Eastern nations to cause disruption and to subvert their power systems is being domestically deployed here. The very same technology, the very same agencies. So I suppose the reason that the control of information is so vital is if you have a well-informed population that are by default in opposition to regulatory measures, are by default against authoritarianism, then it is much harder to whatever the next wave is going to be. It's going to be much harder to implement it when you have a population that's default position is not compliance, but is disobedience and opposition.
Well, I mean, that's it, Russell. And I don't want to understate this or overstate it. There's no way to overstate it. Ladies and gentlemen, humanity is winning. People, on average, get it's a lie. We have 4% uptake on the 10th booster. People get it. So a corrupt, degenerate, inbred power structure that's supposed to be thrown away with a new establishment is being defeated. So their next inclination is, as you said, World War III with Russia to try to overturn the chessboard. So we have actually won the intellectual, cultural, economic, medical debate, but the establishment is so used to victory, they're not going to give up. So in that paradox is where we are right now.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Alex. But sometimes you and I, when we're talking about this, stray into, and it's difficult, I suppose, because it's almost impossible to corroborate. I know that in the earlier part of your career, you looked into the potential occultist forces that are involved. When before you mentioned Epstein and some of the stories around trafficking and exploitation, it seems that like sex and occultism are sort of in the mix here. Do you ever think that you want to not report on that aspect of it? Or do you think that it's vital and is integral to the reporting on these stories to acknowledge that there appears to be some demonic component? Or do you Or do you consider that there might be a benefit in focusing on what can be corroborated? What we're, you know, for example, now, because of the pandemic, you can make those calculations about excess deaths. You can even say something that sounds pretty outlandish to a lot of people, 35 million died from the gene therapies, vaccines, pick your term. What do you feel about getting into the more esoteric stuff around, you know, demonic forces and occultism that might undergird or somehow be behind these power struggles?
Well, look, nobody laughs at us now talking about the occult. And so this is a spiritual battle. This is going on. If you don't recognize that, you can't even respond to it. So this whole system is about getting us to go against the very fabric of who we are. So let's take sex. Sex is a man and woman with all of this evolutionary past, and it's in all the animals, it's in all the plants, like flowers are the sexual organ, the female organ of a plant, to get pollen, the bees separate it all. I mean, so of course, the Satanists obsess on that because they can corrupt that. They've got full control. That's where the real magic's happening. So the occult is all just an inversion of the real power of procreation. The real power of life is about procreation, is about coming together, is about the opposites, is about this magic. So it's not that sex is bad, it's that what they've done to it is bad, corrupting it because it is the fulcrum or the center of the wheel which everything orbits around. So that's why they want to target the children and ruin them early and get them into all of this, because they can then control their psyche into the future. So the fact that we're aware of this gives us amazing foresight and power into the future, that following normal human programs that we were given by God through nature is what we should do. And any attack on that is an attack on our very fundamentals. We are not happy unless we follow these strictures that are incredible. Great lives, great husbands, great wives, great children, grandchildren, the future. It's what we do. It's not like men and women having sex and having children is like some thing we do, like going to a football game. It is what we are. It's what it's all designed. From the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, to the trees, to the flowers, to all the animals, this is what we do. This is a holy ritualistic event of a coming together and competition in life. And so, of course, the Satanists focus on that and twist sex to make us think sex is bad. No, sex is holy. Sex is from God, but it's got to be done the way God directed it. And that's why they're attacking it, is because it's so powerful.
Yes, I see. That everything that is an intersectional point or an interface between the divine and the material, the human and the holy, becomes an interface that ought be tainted. And it also becomes, I suppose, a nexus for power and for control. Because that, I suppose, is one of the questions I still deliberate over. How much can you advance this conversation simply by focusing on matters of dominion and resource? Can you have a conversation with your audience, with your community, where you say, look, it appears that through bureaucracy, they are using crisis to centralize authority, to delegitimize all freedom, to divide us from one another. And then sort of stop there, not to say, and I wonder what the motivation for this could be. It can't just be because they want to have nicer houses and more access to privilege than other people. Perhaps there are darker, I was looking at Ephesians. So is that what you're pulling up now? In the Bible, God's first command to humanity in Genesis is be fruitful and multiply, right? So the sanctity and sacredness of sex. The command is also found in Genesis 9, verses 1 and 7, and chapter 35, 11 in Christian theology. Procreation is seen as a moral command that is part of the creation mandate. In Psalm 127, verse 3, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. And that's in the New King James.
Well, let's expand on that. I want you to go further, because we go back to sex. God gave us sex, not the devil. You grow up, you're like, oh, the devil, cheerleader, Satan, it's fun. I was into all that. I was there. But it's all a perversion. Imagine a man and a woman that love each other get together. They merge their genetics and create a new creature that can create art and literature and is a free will. That is the ultimate ritual. God gave us the powerful ritual of procreation, And so that is what is under attack. So I'll go back to that. Why is Satanism obsessed with sex? Because sex is literally the ritual. It is so powerful. It is so amazing. And then it makes a man and woman who've now come together to make this creature want to defend it and promote it, which goes into the future. It is a union of resistance against anything that will destroy it. So Satan hates that Congress, that alliance of men and women that create the future. That's why we go back to sex, is because everything is about procreation. Everything is about Genesis. Everything is about that wavelength, and that's why it's under attack.
So you think that there is a kind of aim to annihilate all that is holy, to desecrate and destroy all that is beautiful, that we are somehow in a playground of eternity, where great forces through material means conduct a divine battle, a battle where good and evil is literally playing out. And you're saying that sort of the Congress is one of sexual Congress is one of the sort of intersectional points.
But I want to ask you, Russell, looking at all this and the human awakening and the desire for liberty, what is your view right now, your feeling about where humanity is right now?
I love this, those of you that are watching this visually, showing that moment of luxation, that luminous moment of creation, that there is a let there be light moment at the inception of every individual. A beautiful fractal reality plays out. A moment of creation and light at the cellular level. Twice we have been a single cell. Once personally, we have been a single cell, then a dual cell entity. And once more at the beginning of the material journey that itself is divine, even if it plays out in Darwinian terms across the material plane. Twice we have been a single cell, then two cells unfolding through light into this reality. I wonder, Alex, about the extraction of the divine, and I suppose you're asking me a pretty broad question. What happens now? Well, I wonder. I'm terrified. I'm terrified sometimes by what seems to be the incredible scale and scope of power. I'm terrified when I watch it play out domestically in American politics. I am terrified when I see it play out in my country. I'm terrified to see how many things you've said publicly. Aside from the things which you have done your own mea culpas for, the times that you have been ahead of the curve. I said on a show yesterday, I think I was talking to Chris Pavlovsky at Rumble, we've got Alex Jones prior to 9/11 saying there's this guy, Osama bin Laden, the CIA are going to blow up the World Trade Center. They're going to blame it on Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda. Then they're going to use it as an excuse to go to war. I feel that once someone's got the footage of that, you have to consider what that person says pretty carefully going forward. And I've said to you in one of our previous conversations that you, in a culture that revered evangelism, or if not shamanism, which I understand can be seen as trying to use God for your own purposes, but prophecy or channeling or all of the various terms that could be applied to metaphysical discourse, I feel that because we live a materialistic and solely rationalistic life, we've excluded the possibility that people have extraordinary capacities and abilities. Now, when I look at this just on a material plane, Alex, I'm terrified. I'm terrified to see what happens to everyone who speaks out, to everyone who is dissenting. I'm terrified by the various means by which they are leveraging care and safety in order to create more authority. I'm astonished to find that there are large communities of people that consider it necessary to surrender their freedom and are willingly going to be shorn and sheared and castrated. But I am heartened by the amount of resistance. I'm astonished now because of a personal experience, the number of people that absolutely reject what they can plainly see are various media organizations and various online and government entities cooperating in order to generate stories. What I'm excited by now is the ability to form real-time resistance and real-time opposition. For me, I suppose one area of concern is I don't see enough practical political suggestion for us to get behind that to me would represent a pivotal moment of change. You know, the other day I said people would be better off voting for Trump than Biden. And in some media quarters, that, you know, really popped off and people were outraged that anyone could say such a thing. What I would say in my country, where we're about to, it seems, elect another globalist, is other than Nigel Farage, who is very much aligned with a kind of Britain First type movement, there is no populism. And where there is populism, there's very seldom a spiritual dimension. We're mostly talking about sort of patriotism and borders and immigration, which I recognize are very important issues to a lot of people. But what I suppose I am personally excited by and what I consider to be most important is, how do we re-sacralize these spaces? How do we bring God back into the conversation? How do we assert the right to live holy lives? How do we recover ideas like salvation and redemption and atonement and community and unity and service and kindness, all values that appear to have been diluted out and marginalized by a rationalist discourse that leaves us with nothing but individual goals, the kind of individual goals that we were discussing at the beginning of this conversation, that lead people where they may have some talent to use it to simply pursue personal objectives that will ultimately be unfulfilling. There aren't many templates other than Christianity and the Holy Word, and I'm sure there are other people that have contradictory or competing theological or spiritual views, but there aren't many value systems being widely enough promoted in the political sphere to give me serious hope that there is an alternative to either divisive politics that are run along cultural lines or centrist, globalist, corporatist politics. I would love to see more spiritual values injected into the political conversation, and for that to be done in a way that's appealing and inclusive. And
let's speak to that, because I want to ask you. People sit there and they see you accepting God, accepting Christ, and they say, well, this guy's been totally worldly. We can't listen to him. The whole Bible and common sense is God isn't looking for the Pharisees. He's looking for people that were in the system that come out of it, and we judge tree by its fruits. You are now opposing their system. The system is coming after you because you're the prodigal son. You've been through the wilderness. You've experienced it. You're the most credible type person who's actually experienced this, that is now saying God's the answer. We cannot refuse that. That is true. And if we do refuse that, we're working for the system. But yeah, the old New World Order dogma is coming down. People see it, not just Russell Brand or Joe Rogan, or Joe Rogan's like, believes in God now and says, we need God, we need Jesus, because we really do. Because the archetype we've been sold is Satan, is Baphomet, is death. You can joke about it, be cute about it, but this is real. And people can instinctively understand there are no atheists in foxholes. So can you speak to, I already asked the question, but like your spiritual awakening, you reaching out to God, what was that process like, Russell Brand?
There are two sons in the prodigal son parable. The son who wanted his inheritance early and squandered it in a life of philandering and excess. And then there's the older son who stayed home and lived a moral life, but on seeing his father's easy embrace of the returning son, feels resentful that he ain't being sufficiently rewarded for his moral and ethical life. An analysis I recently read points out that our Lord and Savior told that story in front of the Pharisees to make the point that Christianity is for sinners. It's to reach out to those of us that are not of this world, that know that this world is never enough, that try to consume this world and eat this world and have found want in it and find it deficient, that require a spiritual solution. And me, I didn't know where to look for that. People didn't offer me that. Now, I'm really lucky that I found a 12-step solution to my problems with alcohol and drugs, and that opened me up to the possibility, to the certainty that a spiritual solution was what was required. And indeed, it was in being forced to recognize that I built further false idols, vanity, my own success, my own importance. It's a very tenacious idea, the idea of individual success, which I guess is a Luciferian idea, to use the kind of archetypal talk that you were just using there, Alex. Like, when there is great suffering, when I was simultaneously being attacked while my son was having heart surgery while he was 12 weeks old, I was confronted with powerlessness and despair and the recognition that there are dark forces in the world and that there is a requirement for a connection that transcends the self. And whilst I've been praying to God and like I've believed for God a long while and like I have tattoos of Christ on my body, I still, at a deep and unconscious level, was reliant on myself for success or results or for the solution of problems.
You're talking about surrender.
And, yeah, man, surrender. And I could surrender by being broken, by recognizing that of myself, I am nothing. And there was something so important about the human Christ, a figure that is both fully human and fully divine, and the ability and necessity to fully accept, I am redeemed through you, Jesus Christ. None of us come up to the standards of God. If it were down to any of us individually, we are all condemned and we are all damned. But through you, Lord, and through your sacrifice, we are forgiven.
Well, Russell, let me say this.
Not through anything we've done.
Let me say this. I followed you for years. You're a great, smart guy. I met you like over 10 years ago. I can see it physically. You're 10 times more powerful than you ever were. And it's not about being powerful, but you can see Christ in you. Anybody that actually has Holy Spirit vision can see you're for real. So for all the little doubters and Pharisees saying, why is Russell Brand a Christian now? God came for the sinners. God came for me. I was a horrible sinner. I did terrible things. I beat people to death, did all the stuff people do. I was not a conscious Satanist, but I was prideful. I was a Luciferian. By the time I was about 18, I broke from it. And I'm telling you, Russell, you've done it. And they are so upset you've done this. We can see it on you right now. You are so alive. What is it like when you finally metamorphosized and were born again? Was there a moment it happened, or it happened in a process? And how would you, was it a baptism, or how would you describe, because I can see you're born again. What was that like?
Well, it was, you know, the kind of people that are willing to love you in terrifying times, it appears, are not exclusively Christian, but among them there are many Christians. And I didn't make no choice to, I didn't like individually say, what I think I'll do now is get baptized. I can locate for you some significant moments. A friend of mine, my mate Ralph, sent me the book Purpose Driven Life by Rick Warren. I'm reading that book and I saw like some footage of Rick Warren talking about his son ending his life through suicide. And when I saw Rick Warren talking about that, I thought, wow, this guy bears no trace of being a highly regarded pastor and spiritual leader who's had the worst thing happen to him that can happen. His child has taken his own life. He's not carrying any shame for that. He doesn't seem to have a subtext of, well, I guess I'm not all that, because otherwise I'd have been able to prevent my kid from killing himself. He had no trace of that, just openness and honesty and love behind the incredible grief that he was rendering. Then in that book, the first four or five words, it's not about you. Like the recognition, like, oh my God, I keep falling into self-centeredness. I find it so hard not to go back to self-centeredness. And my mate Bear Grylls, you know, like Bear Grylls from Running Wild and a former member of the SAS, you know, he said to me, we're getting baptized, you know, because in that book, it talks about baptism and belonging to a church and reading the word of God. And I'm sort of slowly, reluctantly, tentatively, and with great vulnerability and some resistance doing this. And then he says, we're going to get baptized on the 28th of April. And I'm like, oh, I'm not getting, am I getting baptized? Am I really getting baptized? Is that going to happen? And then, you know, he comes to my house. I live near the River Thames. And him and my mate Joe get in the river with the pasta that he brought with us. And I tell you, I felt like I was coughing stuff up. Like I felt like a real change in the little ceremony.
It was like an exorcism
for it.
You felt it. When you make the decision to go, because I was a devil too. And when I made that move at about 18, I could, you say I was throwing up. It was in my own room by myself, but it's real. You were throwing off all this energy.
Yeah, I feel like it gets on you, man. That stuff is tenacious. And Straight after that, my friend cut his foot up in the River Thames, which is a pretty common experience, actually. And we had to go straight to, like, the emergency room, get my friend's foot stitched up, which Bear Grylls has done a pretty damn good job of binding, actually, because he is, after all, Bear Grylls. And then from that moment, what I feel like is I still feel vulnerable. I still feel tentative. I feel like the need for continual prayer. I feel like the need for continual communion. I feel like I want guidance. But, like, now I know Christ is real. Now I have a relationship with Christ. There is a God, and it is not
what
me.
Happened in
there
the moment God, when you got describe it when you got shoved in the water. What happened?
The moment, like, the build up to it was incredible, and the moment that I felt kind of fearful and afraid, and I was like, this is not just a symbolic act. This is, you know, like, you get underwater pretty regular. I get in cold plunges all the time. I went backwards under that water, Bear Grylls on one side and my mate Joe on the other side. And I came back out and, like, you know, like, and just the, like, you know, received the blessing and everything. And I was just like, I felt very relieved and I felt grace and I felt pretty good, actually, and at ease. But before I could get into communicating about it and saying, hey, I think this is real. This has done something to me. I feel different. My friend had gashed his foot, and Bear Grylls is Bear Grylls. So he's like, we're going to have to go straight to the emergency room. The next 10 minutes is going to require you to be a man, Joe, he said, while pouring a strong disinfectant on my friend's foot and then binding it up, not using leaves and branches, but actually just.
But I want to be clear about this, because I've been through this as well. Anybody that insults the Holy Spirit coming on someone, that's one of the worst curses. People need to realize Saul of Tarsus hunted down Christians by the hundreds and murdered them. And he got hit on the road to Damascus by the Spirit of God. This should be celebrated. And Russell, I can see it in your face. I can see from the person you were before to the person you are now, I can see it in your face. And that's what scares them so much. It's beautiful. I mean, I see Christ working in you. And I want to be clear to listeners. The church is where the devil operates. He takes those over. If you want to find Satan worshipers, go to a mainline church. Almost all the churches are controlled. What do I mean? You got to pray to God and say, God, I want justice. I want freedom. I want to be good. I know this is a spiritual journey. I want you to have the church in me. And it's got to be about that. So don't, because I know so many people look at the church and say, I'm not part of that. Absolutely, we're not part of that. But we have to realize, I don't tell people these stories, but literally, folks, my whole life, it was a fight between the God and the devil in the last 20 years or 30 years. Before that, I made the deal with God 30 years ago. But the point was, it's still been a battle. And now I can't even compute the knowledge I've been given, the discernment, the over-the-horizon knowledge, the things God tells me to show me is wild. And that's only God. I tell the story because it's true. It happened like 4 times in a week about a month ago because God wanted me to follow his orders immediately. So it usually happens like once a month. I'll wake up at 7 a.m., 6 a.m., 5 a.m., and I don't keep my phone. The room is just toxic and bad. There's no phone in the room. It's all dark. And I wake up at 4 a.m., and God goes, go right now to your phone that's laying on the bathroom counter and look at it. It's going to be 4 a.m. And I get up. I walk. It's 4 a.m. And then God goes, now you think that wasn't me. Count down. There's 15 seconds left. I count down, and it goes to 401. And that's the type. This is real, folks. There is a extraordinary outside force that wants us to be successful that is giving us information. But there's also forces that do not want us to be successful. And if you just dial into that's real, then you have all the answers. That's the point I'm making, Russell.
Yeah, it's atemporal and aspatial. That we are in this box of space and time. And within the box of space and time, we only receive limited data and we can only observe limited patterns on a limited sensory bandwidth. Through Christ, all things become possible and all things become available. And just a glimpse of that, just a moment of that passing through me is enough to change me. But this world, with its temptations and with its sin and with its corrupting influences and its systems of control, it too is tenacious. It too don't want to release us. And I feel great revelation and I feel great hope. And sometimes I wonder, is the message just let it all happen? Just let this stuff happen? Because I know that surrender, as you said, Alex, is a big part of this. But when I read, as I am, the Bible, it feels like the early church is a very, very radical movement indeed, that it is about opposing evil very, very directly. Now, I know that none of us individually has the right to suggest or ordain how that might go, but I know that all of us individually and therefore collectively have a duty to find this path, to find this light, and to do our our own best job of conveying it. And it's very difficult for me, Alex, as a person that has always been captivated by these systems, to recognize that this is a different type of surrender. This is a different type of journey. You know, not everything I did was like, you know, like I'm a good stand-up comedian. I'm in movies. It's cool. You know, like I was a sinner and I'm happy to be redeemed. But like I recognize now that that what is required of us is something the reason I bring up that stuff about how do we incorporate this into this movement of resistance, of radicalism, of necessary overthrow and opposition, is because nothing else is going to be able to do it. I can see that.
No, I totally agree. So let me say something about you. I got to meet you in a few interviews when you were, you know, married to the big music star, and you were telling me about behind the scenes and on air about your awakening to the Illuminati. Then I met you in Austin. I went to one of your events, and you were a big, powerful guy. You're a powerful spirit. You can see it. Like, wow, that's Russell Brand. This guy's, you know, intimidating, just like Trump is, or, you know, other people like that. Like, oh, God, this guy's important. But then I could still see in your eyes, you were like shifting in and out. You were conflicted. You weren't a Satanist and you weren't a Christian. I could see like in your eyes, like bzz, 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 you were like back and forth. Now, I'm only telling you this because everybody can see it. You are so powerful now in Christ. They can see that, so they will come after you. What is the process in your family like? Because I can see it over this video conference. I'm sure what are your dreams now? Because with me fully joining Christ, it's just insanely good. I can't believe nobody what is it like for you now that you are serving Christ and it's going on for years? Now you're declaring it, which they come after you for. What was that threshold like?
Well, what I feel like now, Alex, is that what I do next is not going to be determined by me. And you know that, of course, personally, because of the significant opposition and the nature of the attacks that anyone who's in this space is likely to receive. It's incredible to be in a family. It's incredible to suddenly recognize what incredible gifts I've been given. I've got 3 children. I've got 2 daughters. I've got a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old that adore me and love me. I've got a beautiful, kind wife. I recognize now that I've been defined by greed and wanting and longing and always wanting more. I've been given the gift of a little son who, when I heard in that scan that he was going to be born with a heart condition and that there were going to be challenges and necessary surgery and that he might not make it and that they were offering, you know, to terminate that pregnancy, this offering of my son, the experience of being in hospitals where you are surrounded by sick children, children that are not going to make it. When you walk through an oncology ward while escaping paparazzi, while facing mass attacks, you recognize that where the truth is amidst suffering. You recognize that beauty is abundant and that suffering grants us the opportunity to suffer correctly and to let go of a lot of things that I was gripping onto that were meaningless. When I first heard that my child was going to be born with these problems, I said to my wife, I rejected it. I don't want to go through this. I don't want to go through the experience of children's hospitals and tubes up the nose and surgery. Now I know what a blessing it is to be in a children's hospital, to hand over your child to an anesthetist, to have your child with tubes up their little nose, to come back and be told that the surgery was a success, to walk the halls of a hospital where every child is suffering from a life-threatening condition or perhaps is blessed enough to have been saved, where every doctor, where every nurse is dedicated to something important and significant. Suddenly, like any of us that have suffered through the suffering, you recognize that you have been in illusion, that it might not be some incredible lightning flash or thunder clap, but it might be love that shows you your vulnerability, love that shows you a different path. Now I recognize that my pathway will be different. I know that I am still going to experience fear. I hate feeling fear, Alex Jones. I do not enjoy that feeling of being attacked. I do not enjoy the feeling of knowing that there are dark powers in high principalities out there. I do not like it, but I know that there is a higher grace and I know that there is a higher power. And I know that if I continue to surrender and yield, that power is available, not to me to serve myself, but for me that I may be useful. And this is the early days of this journey for me. So I'm undertaking it with tutelage and guidance and with tentativeness, and I hope humility, because I can see that humility is what is absolutely vital in this position.
In closing here, because we just had Tucker Carlson on, we're airing this right now, we're taping this on Thursday, it airs tomorrow, could be our last show, the planets align with Tucker and you. The judge says he's probably shutting it down tomorrow, which we're airing this right now on Friday. In closing, because you and Tucker are very, you know, very, very humble, we need people to celebrate folks who are telling the truth, that are leaders. How do people find Russell Brand, all the things you do?
We stream every day at 12 ET on Rumble, the free speech platform. That's where you can find me. Please follow us there if you are inclined. It's free every day for 1 hour, streaming live, 12 ET. Thanks, Alex.
Russell, thank you so much. And again, how do people follow you on X?
I think I'm called Rusty Rockets or something bloody stupid, but it'll come up under Russell Brand, I think, as well.
All right, brother. Thank you so much. And it's beautiful to see what you've done in your life. You've always been a powerful soul, and it's good to be on the same team. We really love Russell Brand. Thank you, Russell Brand.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Alex.
Welcome to the fourth hour of the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer. Jay's now also so glad to be back. So honored to be here after 4 years now of hosting the fourth hour. It's been amazing. I've had a blast doing it. So honored. And hopefully we can continue. Hopefully the news will be positive. In case it isn't the positive news that we hope for, in case it's bad news, I thought it might be good to go ahead and do the possible last fourth hour as a summation of the many global elite texts that we've done by focusing on a new one that I picked up recently. You know that in the fourth hours, we've done many of these. I've mentioned in the last 6 or 7 years, probably about 60, maybe more global elite texts that we worked through. This includes white papers. It includes big fat tomes, geopolitical analyses, Brzezinski, Quigley, Kissinger types, Rockefellers, many, many others. And we covered one of the key texts by a guy named Jacques Attali, who you probably don't know about him very much in America, but he was the Kissinger of France. In fact, Kissinger wrote the blurb there on the 2006 publication, Brief History of the Future. And when we analyzed that text, we saw all kinds of really deep predictive elements that we might not think would be that ahead of time. We might be surprised to see things in 2006 playing out. But I found his 1991 text, Millennium, that I read this week. And it's amazing because it's even more predictive and even more concise than the larger book from 2006. And this was right when Attali was placed at the head of one of the biggest banks that was in charge of restructuring the former Soviet bloc countries after the wall had fallen. This book was written right after the wall fell. And he was in charge of restructuring the economy of the Soviet bloc countries to fit it into the Western neoliberal model of IMF, debt-based fiat control. The foreword to the book is written by another key global elite architect, Alvin Toffler. Toffler wrote many famous books like Future Shock, other texts where he talked about in the coming technocratic order, they would organize society around alternative lifestyles, and they would even tie things like anarchism, communism, socialism, et cetera, these kind of grassroots so-called movements, they would tie them into new diet lifestyles. Vegetarianism, veganism would be promoted. Toffler wrote about this in the late 70s, early 80s. And so he writes the foreword to one of his other cohorts in this technocratic globalist order, talking about and praising the character of Jacques Attali, again, as the sort of Kissinger of France. He was to be the head of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. That is also at the same time as the public announcement of the European Union. And we have to keep in mind that the European Union, as you know from other texts like Daniel Estulin's Bilderberg Group book, as Johann Ratzio's book on the Fabian Society point out, the EU was actually planned in the 1940s and 50s by the OSS, the CIA, and Bilderberg. So it was actually a project that had been in the works for a long time, publicly announced in the early 90s. And Atta Lee was chosen to be the head of one of these key institutions that would restructure the Soviet countries into not freedom and free market, that's what it's sold as, but rather into the IMF, Bank for National Settlements, Federal Reserve, fiat debt usury control system model. And so Atta Lee was chosen as one of these key, I guess you could say in the words of John Perkins, economic hitmen to restructure and control. Now, amazingly, Atta Lee is not just a person that you think of as this sort of boring banker. He's also very interested in philosophy. He's interested in culture war. He's interested in intelligence studies, history, socialism, communism, transhumanism. All of those things are elements that Atta Lee focused intently on in his many, many books. And not many of them have actually been translated into English. So it's good to see some of the texts that were translated from the French into English. And again, he's kind of like a Kissinger in that he was the consultant, the handler, you might even say, to former French presidents like Jacques-François Mitterrand. Don't go anywhere. This is the Alex Jones Show. We will continue with this global elite text from Jacques Attali when we return. Welcome back to the fourth hour of the Alex Jones Show. And we're talking about the important text from 1991, Jacques Attali's Millennium. Winners and losers in the coming what? World order. Coming world order. And we know, of course, by analyzing so many of these texts, even going back 100 plus years to people like John Russell, H.G. Wells, people from the Royal Society, the Rothschilds, Milner circles, that the world order that we're going into, the global order as the new global order, as Toffler calls it in his introduction to Attali's book, was something planned a long time ago. So it's very useful, it's very instructive to read these texts, to go back to these texts. And I dare say no one else on the internet, other than Alex sort of mentioning and going through these texts for many, many years, no one else has actually lectured through dozens and dozens of these as we have. So the key to that is just, you know, reading, taking the time, analyzing it, and then I kind of put it in, I do my homework for you. And that way you don't have to sit and read all these boring books. You can get the quick download of what all of these texts are saying and the unified plan that they've had for over 100 plus years to bring in this technocratic global order that they're rolling out. And that's why we've done this. And it's amazing what they admit in the books. And we do this because we want to understand not just what they planned a long time ago, but also what they might be rolling out in the near future. What are the things that we might expect in the near term to be rolled out and to be given to us or forced down our throat, I guess I should say, in the words of BlackRock's Larry Fink. So the book begins by talking about what to expect in the coming world order. The first chapter is about the fall of the wall, the Cold War opening up the Soviet bloc countries to what you might think is a free market economy, but it's not. It's a way to restructure them under this debt model. And Attali says some pretty shocking things at the beginning that you might not. You might think, well, I need to go read Karl Marx and read Adam Smith. And Attali says, you know what's a better model for understanding the world that we're going into? The movie Blade Runner. He says the movie Blade Runner will be more important than mastering or knowing the text of Marx's Das Kapital or Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And he says that, as many of the other global elite texts have said, Klaus has said, as World Economic Forum has said many times over, the future cannot have a dominant America. America must be taken down a few pegs. It must radically transform, to use the terminology of Attali. We must have an end of the nation states. And one of the ways to do that is to create a global economy based around fast money. Now, we're already kind of at that point. I don't know that we can ever stop that. So we might want to choose the options for global money that are the hardest forms of money, that don't become susceptible to government manipulation or private manipulation, something like Bitcoin. He says there will be an end of nation states, and that's necessary to go into this order. And the way that we will do that, he says, is through what he calls nomadic devices. You'll recall that in his 2006 book, I thought that it was very prescient and very, very powerful that he predicted things like the iPhone and that it would create a nomadic society where people would no longer be attached to the roots of their heritage, their family, their culture, their tradition. Rather, they would be able to roam about and their lives would be lived out on their phones. or on their laptops or whatever the nomadic devices are. He talks about different generations of these nomadic devices that eventually it will become a kind of a computer chip or a brain chip or a nanotech chip in the mind. And if we look back, we'll recall that Atali says that the future of this whole order is, in fact, transhumanism. He says that transhumanists are the spearhead of revolution in our day. So hyper-democracy ultimately results in transhumanism. So you understand this is a transhumanist banker is what we're talking about. There he is talking about. Now, that's what he said in 2006, and I thought that was pretty ahead of its time. But in fact, he actually says the same thing in 1991. The first chapter deals with, and the last chapter deals with, nomadic devices as a way to break down your sense of yourself, your identity, your connectedness to your family. And by breaking down the connectedness to family and other human beings through social media, the internet, tech, nomadic devices, it would then break down the ties of the nation state. And then the nation state would break down, and you would eventually be part of a global monoculture. He says that if you want to understand what he projects the decline of America to be like, he says it's like the decline of the Spanish Empire. He says a direct parallel between these two. And the decline of the Spanish Empire was not because of factors that you might expect, like being invaded or something like that. No, he says it was massive debt. He says the key to other nation states or empires lasting longer than America or the Spanish Empire, he says, was avoiding debt and avoiding foreign entanglements and conflicts, the very thing that the founding fathers of America understood would be the thing that would lead to the decline. And here we are with what Brzezinski and the Council of Foreign Relations said is the Pax Americana, the American Empire. And what does it do? It has to sustain itself through constant wars in Ukraine, wars in other countries, war here, war there, war in Yemen, war in this and that, through proxies, through whatever. It's all now a system based around no longer producing things. That's the deindustrialization that occurred through the RAND Corporation and its machinations to take us away from an industrial economy and into a service-based economy. That's all tied to the greater increasing adoption of the debt fiat model of currency, meaning the debasement of the money and the purchasing power through inflation and through the Fed. He says that it's clear as day. This is a top banker. He says that America will fall, not because of the lack of its creativity of its people or the power of its military, but through massive debt. The number one problem, he says, is massive debt. So he's not saying this to help America. He's definitely a globalist. He doesn't have any concern or interest in America being. In fact, he wants to see it brought down to bring in the internationalist order that he supports. In fact, he says that social justice will be a key issue of the future. Again, surprising that one of these guys in 1991 was talking about, quote, social justice. Now, I know that social justice warriors and this kind of stuff comes out of the 60s, but here we have one of the top bankers admitting that the future will see an emphasis on, quote, social justice. He says that we will transition into a service-based economy, and that out of the dialectical clash of the Cold War, what we've seen is monopolistic capitalism clashing against collectivism, and he says we've gotten the dialectical solution, which is a merger, a kind of a new order of the future that he in his very day in 1991 after the fall of the wall was beginning to see emerge. He says this will give rise to a technocracy based around microchips, biometrics, and genetically modified organisms. 1991, he says that. Now, is this not a proof that the power elite plan and structure the future? Now, you might be tempted to think, well, this is blackpilling. I'm going to be blackpilled. I can't listen to this anymore. No, I got good news. Because guess what? The two key chapters that this book was written for, Jacques Attali was dead wrong about. Although he predicted and got a lot of things correct, he made some huge miscalculations. And I'm assuming the global elite along with him did as well. They actually thought at this time And I remember in the 1990s, there was a lot of books being printed about the rise of Japan. Attali thought that because of the connection between Japan and tech, that Japan would be the future potential empire. And he writes about that in an entire chapter. He was very wrong about that, because, in fact, Japan went through, from this very time of the mid-90s, early 90s until 2023, what they called something like the stagnation years. So the entire Japanese economy was in like a 30-year stagnation. And at the same time, Attali says, well, if it's not going to be Japan that is the future center of the world order, the new city of power, the city-state that rises to kind of be the global power, he says it'll be the EU. Well, he was also wrong about that. The EU has not become the center of the global technocratic order. But that doesn't mean he's not right in a lot of other areas, and that there's not a lot of other predictions and plans that we can suss out from this book. He notes that in his day, he actually saw the color revolutions that the CIA put on in Europe, and he uses as one of his examples the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia as one of the key means to reorganize and open up these societies for a new technocratic future. And he says that large-scale migrations of populations into these countries was enabled after the fall of the wall and after the Iron Curtain being removed, so that you could have economic liberalism as the means for importing all kinds of low-wage migrant workers. And he says that this is a plan to ensure pluralism, quote-unquote, which is really just weapons of mass migration, the Kelly Greenhill book. That's a military academic text. It's not a conspiracy text. It's a famous book about a population being used to as a form of warfare. And he says that this opening of the gates, opening of the doors through the economic policies allowed for the transformation of the nations into the future world order, which will allow for an empire of the future. Now, the problem with this is that doing this doesn't actually empower the target union or nation. It actually brings it down. And so it can't actually then become some new center of power. So whether they're dumb and they don't realize that because they're so committed to their ideology, or they're very cunning and wicked and know that, and they do it on purpose to destroy the countries, it's kind of hard to figure out, because on the one hand, they want at times to say that, oh, the EU will be the power center of the future. And yet they're doing the very thing that destroys the power of that entity. So it makes no sense. I think there's a combination of both. There's a combination of the belief in their weird, insane ideologies. And at the same time, there's factions of the elite that are cunning and deceptive enough to know that this doesn't actually produce anything positive or any real power. It actually destroys. He says that we will get to this technocratic order because technocracy allows and offers everybody security and immediacy. So the temptation to have everything at your fingertips, the immediacy that you get, will be enough to ensure that people opt into this system and thus surrender their sovereignty, their individuality, and all that. And he says, rights, for example, he says there's a contradiction in the global consumerist ideology, which is that it's based around these assumed rights to have pleasure, happiness, consumable goods with no end. And he says that there really is no basis for these rights. This is actually a point we make all the time. Without the existence of the transcendent, of God or something like that, there's no belief in rights or dignity. Where do we see these rights? If man is just another animal from the natural world, then there's no such thing as rights. They're just human social constructs. They don't exist under a microscope. And so if there are no rights, as Attali points out, then he says we're going to actually have to have some kind of new future religion. And he actually says we need a new version of the sacred. We'll just make up a new religion that fits into this global technocratic order. He says to do this, we're going to look back at history and we're going to learn some history lessons. And he says the history lesson that I want to give you is the historical forms of where we got government, where we got authority, and where we got power. He says, if we go back to the ancient societies, this is always what we get, by the way, in the global elite text. They love to give you this history lecture, and they essentially present it as if their version is the necessary, absolutely destined future that logically follows from their analysis of history. And he points out that the ancient world was organized into hierarchies, and these were hierarchies made up arbitrarily to ensure the furtherance of the survival of that society, of that tribe or that empire. So made up categories were invented about kings or rulers or warriors, and they were placed above everyone else. And at the same time, they had to create enemies, scapegoats, villains, and so forth to monitor and control violence. This allowed the state to have the monopoly of violence. And then they also had to organize society around the notion of sacrifice. All societies have had some version of the priesthood and the prince working together to control violence and to channel that violence into some form of, quote, sacrifice. Thus, the control of society is ultimately, he says, the control of force or violence. And he says you can relate this to three realms: the control of society or violence through religion, through the military, and through economy. Thus, the sacred, he argues, was always at the service of these three power entities. Religious power, however, over time became displaced by the military power. And so we transition away from society trusting the priesthood and turning over. This is beginning to actually sound more and more kind of like Nietzsche, right? And the priesthood then conceded in history over power to the military. The military, however, eventually started conceding power to economy, to the money power. Thus, in each of these phases, you could say, the sacred becomes whatever is the dominant control power structure. First, it's religion. Then it becomes military that's sacred. And then it becomes the monetary power, the money power that is the sacred. In each of these societies or these phases, authority is connected to that religious power. He says in the ancient world, the whole world was seen as an integrated whole. Everything was integrated, and thus even trees and rocks had some sort of divine spirit in this holistic worldview. As time progresses, however, objects that are seen to have a sacred or transcendental value lose that because they become commodities. So animism and the fetishism of objects, you could say, caves to objects becoming products in a consumable way, and that's the structure that you would expect under the rule of the money power, or what he calls the order of money on page 22. Money is a radical new way of controlling violence that is far superior to all the other ways of controlling violence. Money then becomes connected to the order under which it is subsumed, particularly connected to technology. So the better and more advanced the technology gets, the more efficient and the more useful the money power becomes and the more powerful it becomes. He says that we're entering into, and today, as the emergence of the tech order, this is again 1991, so right before the omnipotence and omnipresence of the internet, he's saying that we're emerging into a new market form where at the center will be whatever and wherever is the new technocratic power. I don't know where he gets these cities, but he says that there's eight city-states in the history of the world that had key centers of power. And he says that we're now entering into the ninth form of this. And he says this will be the crucial final form, perhaps. But he says it'll all be based around the efficient technology that allows for the fast transfer of money or whatever is symbolizing that money or energy transfer. Does this sound like anything? He says that will be the future, and wherever that is centered will be the future power structure. This sounds like Bitcoin. I'm not saying he planned Bitcoin. He doesn't know about that. This is way before Bitcoin. But he's saying that the future will necessarily be connected to wherever and however money is easily transferred in an instant that's not under the control or the surveillance of any single centralized entity. It doesn't take a PhD, rocket science, to figure out oh, when I understand the mechanics of Bitcoin, it actually solves that. It actually is that. The very thing that he's predicting would be the necessary element of a future power structure that will rule the next phase. He says that in the history of the world, there were 8 city-states. He calls these forms. There was Bruges in 1300, Venice in 1450, Antwerp in 1500, Genoa in 1550, Amsterdam in 1650, London in 1750, Boston in 1880, New York in 1930 via Wall Street and the banks. He says it remains to be seen what the next city-state will be and what that power structure will look like. But he says it will necessarily be connected to the speed of money transfer and the money power. Now, remember, when I say the money power, on the one hand, I'm talking about the existing Bretton Woods Federal Reserve banking system, which is based around fiat. I'm saying the real money power will be the person who invents a solution to fiat debasement, centralized control, infinitely inflatable money. Oh, wait a minute. That's been invented, called Bitcoin. Again, if you read this book and you're perceptive and you understand what Bitcoin is, you understand that that is the future. And even though Atali doesn't know about Bitcoin, what he's saying equates to that if you're perceptive. Now, Atali moves on to say, how are we going to get to these states? Well, this future state, he says, if you notice, I don't know where he gets this, but he says in every one of these previous economies, as they move these big key city states in the past, he says, as they move towards the modern form, the family gets reduced in power and more power is conceded to the market. He says eventually the merchant class rises to power. And one of the things that enabled the merchant class to come to power was technology. Various city states have become these centers and constellations of industry based around the technology that they developed and that they house and that they cling to. He says that post 1930, the money power world that we've entered into is the Fabian model. He says Keynesianism is the present order in which we live. That is the post-World War II Bretton Woods model that was designed and organized entirely and in toto by Fabian socialist economists. That is Keynesianism, the New Deal, monopolistic, reformed Marxism / capitalism. Those are the same things. Madison Avenue, Wall Street, they are all part of that structure. He says that whatever we go into will be the one that advances upon that horrible garbage trash system that we have. The next chapter talks about the struggle for supremacy, and he gives a very odd occultic image. And this really, I think, backs up a lot of what you've heard me say over the years, that the Cold War was a dialectic. In fact, Atali draws for you a pyramid with 2 pillars. He doesn't draw this. I'm saying he draws it in the text. So I drew it for you. And he says that the Cold War was this pyramid in the middle with the U.S. dollar as the power structure. And he says the 2 pillars next to that are, if you think about Masonry, Yakin and Boaz, right? The U.S. pillar and the USSR pillar. He says the fall of the Cold War eliminated this pillar. And so now we have one order that is the future order that we're going into that is the technocratic order. It's a very odd imagery, clearly Masonic imagery that he's drawn for us in this chapter. But again, here's where he fails. He says Japan and the EU will run the New World Order. Well, that surely hasn't happened. This is the Alex Jones Show. Going where? Welcome back to the fourth hour of the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jader. I'm Jason Alsos. And we're talking about the very prescient text from one of the global elite technocrats, Jacques Attali, his 1991 book, Millennium, Winners and Losers in the Coming World Order, with the foreword by Alvin Toffler. And as I mentioned, the next chapter goes into discussing the possibilities of Europe or the EU, which had just been announced here at this time, right around this time, and Japan being the future of the world order as America declines. And that's an example of the global elite not always getting it right. They don't have omnipotence. They're not all powerful. They're not God. They make mistakes. They do plan way ahead. That's what we see from these texts, these projections that they put forward for how to get to the end goal of the full technocratic order, which, as we know in this book, goes into much more detail by saying that, look, the goal is to have everybody linked into a giant global brain, to have everybody controlled, tracked, and traced down to their very genetics. And he calls it the golem. So that's the goal. But we can see that this was planned, again, decades, many decades before. And he thinks that whoever, again, controls transportation and technology in the future will be key. However, he does note that it's hard to see how this will happen given the fact that Europe has a negative population growth rate. So I don't know how he thought that would happen. And he says, well, what we'll have to do is we'll collapse old Europe. Old Europe must collapse, which is the very, very thing that General Wesley Clark said as well. And it's also a part of the Kuhnhoff-Kalergi plan, which is not a conspiracy theory. It's actually mentioned by Dr. Carol Quigley in his book, Anglo-American Establishment, that the Royal Society elite did choose to adopt the Kalergi plan. It's an actual real thing, Count Kuhnhoff-Kalergi, to destroy the existing European nation states by population warfare. So that's a real thing, and it's discussed. Atali doesn't mention Kalergi. He just mentions the destruction of the old order of Europe by replacing it with a whole bunch of new people. He says that this is connected to the new market order and democratic institutions, which require pluralism. Of course, it's all arbitrary because, well, what kind of pluralism? I mean, what is America other than a social construct? Who are you to say that you have something that all the migrants don't have, you see? He says that what will be required is a sea change. The winds of change must blow through all of the world post-fall to understand that we're entering into a global democratic order, they call it. But of course, that doesn't mean anything related to, it's just total oligarchic control. And that also reminds me of the Winds of Change song, which came out right around this time, which was actually a CIA operation. If you don't know, you can look that up. I think it was Scorpions. Take me to the magic of the moment. It's a really annoying song, but that's actually a CIA-promoted song, When the Wall Fell. The Winds of Change is the winds of Western liberalism blowing through and destroying, supposedly, its dialectical opposition, Soviet communism. In fact, in this very chapter, Atali says that I was chosen to be the head of the institution in charge of integrating Eastern Europe into the, quote, New World Order. The first pan-European institution, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, is a $12 billion bank which I will head. This will be for integration into the European community, and this will be intending to construct a European common home where the bank will play a similar role that the European coal and steel community of the 1950s played as a cornerstone of the integration into the European community. If you remember, that was a key section in the Johann Rattu book on the Fabian Socialists, that when the OSS and CIA understood that they would have to integrate Europe to control it, they utilized as their first front and outlet the European coal and steel community development. So it was done via corporate control. EU integration was a long-standing plan, and the stability of this emerging European sphere depends on how well they control Germany. A united and controlled Germany is key to controlling the EU, he says. That's, of course, why the CIA has had such a crucial power control role in Germany since World War II. And that's well known. It was a big part of the Rattu book as well. He says, we are entering into the new form, the ninth market form, and it will be centered around some hinterland and periphery that is dominated in the way that he hopes to see the European Common Bank or whatever he's part of dominant. So he's thinking, he's hoping he's going to be, I guess, the king of the New World Order at this giant European bank. Of course, again, that didn't happen. So even though he was a very, I guess he still is, if you saw, he's a very important technocratic person in the global power structure. He's, you know, one of these technocratic elite planners that writes all these books like a Brzezinski or Kissinger. He didn't end up becoming king of the New World Order. Next, he goes on to talk about the way this is always structured is that you have a sphere of control and you have a periphery. So that's ironic because it's almost like it's still the imperial model. The imperial model is, of course, that you have the center city state of the empire, and then the colonies sort of bring in and feed the economic resources, the goods, the products to the center. And then in exchange, the monetary blessings and the law, the Pax Romana, the Pax Americana, then are supposed to filter out to the colonies that are in union with the Imperium. The problem, of course, is that empires often fall due to the desire to take on more and more debt to sustain the engine of the empire. Now, it doesn't actually have to be that way. There's nothing about an Imperium that necessitates that it has to constantly go into giant debt. But what often happens is that because the empire has the temptation to utilize the power of the central money control, that they can thus steal from the future generations via the debt-based money system, the fiat system. Fiat system is just basically stealing from the purchasing power of the future. It's stealing the time, the wealth, and the energy of the people in the present and the future through the debasement of the currency. So it's such a temptation to empires that when empires get more and more corrupt in history, they invariably fall into debasing their currency because it's such an easy way to control and to steal. So it's almost impossible to solve this problem when there's always the temptation to use that as the way out of a declining empire. And thus, as the empire declines, the more it then debases and inflates its currency to pay off the debts, which can never be paid because the interest just stacks up more and more and more. That's where we are. And Attali is saying correctly that the exact same thing is happening to the American empire. And it can never be fixed by more wars, more kicking the can down the road. Eventually, the debt collapses the system. Then he goes on to say a very powerful statement that by 2050, the world will have too many people. We'll have 8 billion people. And he's actually wrong because I think we're already, what, at 9 billion or something, supposedly. And he says that the world can't sustain that. So we always get into the sustainability claims that the world is overpopulated. By 2050, there'll be too many people. And he says that the United States will experience migration that will upset the cultural balance, that will transform the very nature of America itself. It will sever it from its Anglo-Saxon European origins and turn it into something else. The notion of a gigantic melting pot is not without basis. Europe is likely to have troubles as well. The logic of the continual integration and the long bloody tradition of ethnic and national rivalries and chauvinism and xenophobia will continue. However, mass migration from Africa might solve these problems. These migration nomads will be regulated since the rationalized continual flow of migrants will seem to be advantageous. Advantageous to who? To the corporate elite that run it, to restructure and to reintegrate and to remake Europe into something else. So in other words, to have a EU, you got to get rid of Germans, Italians, French, Poles, etc. You must have a continual open border model to create a gigantic homogenous melting pot that is the true EU. Then he says that the workers and the planet will have to figure out ways to integrate into the new green economy. The future will be based around pollution and carbon taxes, carbon emissions, and carbon being controlled, because of course carbon is just human life forms. He says that there's too many people and there's too much carbon dioxide, there's too much coal, oil, and natural gas. and that this is actually destroying the ozone layer, which is all a bunch of nonsense. So he says that the only way to get around this is to figure out ways to radically depopulate. Every global elite person says all the exact same things. Depopulation, population control, mega cities he talks about. He says that if we don't deal with this and get to less population and less carbon emissions, this is the same propaganda all these idiots have said. In the near future, many key ocean cities will sink. So if you're in New York, or if you're in the cities in Florida on the coast, coastal cities are about to sink in the next couple decades. Again, how many of the global elite goons have said that all the cities are going to be sinking? It's all baloney, and they all end up buying coastal property because the idiots buy into that and then sell their property, and then these people buy it up. Green Marxism, green socialism, green Fabianism is the future. He says eventually the European countries will introduce carbon taxes, taxes on breathing and emitting carbon dioxide. The emissions of North America and Europe have only fallen slightly. Chlorofluorocarbons are heating up the atmosphere, melting the ice caps, and we're going to sink the coastal cities. Again, fake crises. And he says that the future will be a world where ethnic and racial division comes back. There will be huge opposition between Islam and Christianity in the coming world order. Of course, that was what Bernard Lewis and Samuel P. Huntington also predicted, because they're all part of the same global elite structures. They were planning and strategizing the future Western civilization conflict with, quote, Islam. And he says that this is based around racism. Well, wait a minute, I thought there was two different religions. Oh, no, it's racism if you're against Islam, apparently. Nomadic devices is where he kind of concludes this work. And this is where we get into the elements that are so important for predicting the transhumanist future that he wrote about in his 2006 book. This lets us know that the things that are rolled out, you know, the devices that we have, a lot of this is planned for social control. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with the devices or the technology, but that it's literally there to, as William Binney, the famous architect of many of the NSA programs during the Cold War, said in his famous whistleblower interviews with Richard Grove and others, that the purpose of these NSA developments and the technology coming out of that, which gave us the internet, is, quote, total human control. That's the purpose. It's not to free you. It's not to allow you to have your small business at home. We have all those things, and those are great advantages and blessings, but that's not the ultimate goal of all this. The ultimate goal is that, as Atali says, the hyper-industrial age will give rise to the nomadic devices that will sever us from our root and from our sense of ourselves and from our meaning and from our situatedness, right, in some culture, in some religion. This will give us new relationships to city, to the family, to life, and even to death. He's saying that these devices will come to take on a almost divine, semi-divine status, and they will get smaller and smaller over time. Remember when he was writing this in the 1990s, computers were gigantic, 200-pound things you had to lug around. And now an entire computer is smaller than this, right? He says this is going to continue to get smaller and smaller and more advanced, to the point to where it becomes an implantable microchip or some sort of nanotechnology. He says that whoever is around the centers of the new tech will be the centers of the new wealth and the new power of the future. He says, again, remember that the previous empires and city-states always collapsed due to debt. Excess debt always leads to excess inflation, bankruptcy, and ultimate collapse. This occurs when businesses are able to apply new technology to services previously outside of the market and thereby transform all the commodities into something cost-efficient. Thus, new technology is the engine of the new wealth creation. So wherever we find the new wealth creation and the new tech is where you need to look for the future power structure. There was a push for higher education in the 1950s in America. This was done in response to the Soviet claims about the launch of Sputnik, and thus Americans saw the need to create a great many universities all over, such as the University of California. In the 1960s, the birth of Medicare confirmed the right to health care for all women and for all men and women. And this would actually come to exert enormous strains on the federal budget. At the same time, the military costs continue to escalate in the Cold War and the buildup to Vietnam. Thus, more and more America took on greater projects, greater centralized planning projects, and greater debt, such that an awareness that the debt could not be repaid led to the financial chaos and crisis of the 1980s and the savings and loan crisis. When it was realized that the debts could never be repaid, major banking institutions and historical patterns emerged, whereby we began to see the boom-bust cycle repeat, and it became evident that more and more debt was promoted on purpose to sustain crazy lifestyles, or the American consumerist lifestyle, and that no one was saving their money anymore. So the promotion, as you heard even Tucker say earlier, of college kids being hooked on credit cards and getting greater and greater debt was all by design to convert Americans over into living under debt slavery and the acceptance of living under debt slavery, which had already occurred in the 1980s when they figured out that the U.S. debt can't be repaid. Then people were just sort of defaulting into a nihilistic abandon to want and to desire the latest consumable objects that are also replaced within a few years, such as stereos, CDs, VCRs, and even computers. So it's not about quality products anymore. It's about a model of planned obsolescence to further the engine of consuming. The growth of debt in turn deepened the crisis by generating sustained further growth of services to manage the debt. This was then handed over to banks of all kinds, which proliferated, and then we got giant debt bubbles, banking bubbles, debt bubbles. And he says that if you look back to the history of other civilizations, for example, what allowed Amsterdam to become the world power city-state at that time was because they invented a new, faster boat called the flyboat in 1590. The flyboat allowed Amsterdam to become extremely wealthy. And he says, if you want to project this example into the future, history is full of these. And the economic renewal of the future will be centered around whoever introduces mass application of new technologies that reduce the costs and social demands through substituting products and services. Bitcoin. The technology that will permit this future form is more and more connected to the microchip. The future will be a borderless world based around the control of information, InfoWar, big data, and the flow and privacy of information is the future. Robotics will continue to take control and will rise to the ascendancy to become the workers of the future. The real growth in the future industries will take place as services are replaced, and including education, by screens and objects. You're going to be taught by, this is what he wrote in the 2006 book too, your own AI companions. They will be the medium between you and the outside world. The future AI will be, this is rolling out now, right? That will be what educates you. That will be what does the work and the services. Atali says in 1991, the rise of AI will determine a lot of these service sectors. He says, eventually all of your information will be stored on various chips or cards, and they will either be a card that you carry or a chip eventually that's implanted in you. He says that the key thing to look at in the future is the cell phone. In 1991, Atali was telling you about the cell phone. He says that you might think that in this future world where everyone sort of is nomadic and works from home or works on their devices, which is where we are, exactly what happened. He says you might think that there would be much more time for leisure. No, in fact, everyone will work far more in the future than they do in the present 40-hour work week. He says this mass tech society will produce mass standardization, even to the point where in the future we'll have an AI doctor who will diagnose you and will replace eventually human doctors. AI will be proficient enough to diagnose you better than a human. And in fact, that even beauty standards will suffer because the cults of the future will have homogenized and idealized views of beauty. You might even argue that that's not even true, that actually it becomes the worse. It becomes that the more and more ugly you are, the better for your fitting into that order, because that's what's required by standardization. So making everyone fat and ugly actually standardizes in a much more efficient way for efficiency and consumerism than a model where people are trying to shoot for some sort of idealized body, be it male or female. Citizens of this fast world will expect immediacy, but they will have to work very hard to have any autonomy. Advancing your career will depend upon maintaining constant levels of new degrees in education. There will be no future for any unskilled labor because they will all be replaced by machines. Rise of the machines. There will be, however, a proliferation of health clubs, fitness clubs, self-help books, and constant ongoing adult education through university extension courses. He was right about all that. The future cultural image and ideal will be that of the movie star, or we might say now the influencer, right? Or the TikTok, Instagram influencer. They will become the future celebrities that people try to shoot for to become. And society will have to invent new scapegoats to be the bad men of the demonized class or whatever. He says it might be people who are out of shape or something like that might be considered. No, he got that part backwards. So it's actually we're going to the future where fat acceptance and so forth. He says the objects of the future that you will wear will control and monitor your heartbeat, your blood pressure, your cholesterol, Fitbit. He says the future will be a nomadic one where everyone is dominated and ruled by their screens. Screens. Even cancer treatments and surgery will eventually be done and administered via AI machines. These nomadic objects will allow children to learn, and all of their knowledge, their pedagogy, will be done through screens and AI. Humans will just sort of default to trusting the AI and allowing their children to be raised by these machines. And allow people will then live by proxy. You won't need to go visit a place. You will just look and see what that place is like on a screen. Thus, humans will be manipulated by images and screens. Tomorrow's children will learn by a computer teacher rather than a human. Now, he goes on to say many more things, but I want to remind you that I'll be live June 22nd in Las Vegas. Hopefully, this isn't the last InfoWars broadcast, but if it is, I've been very honored. Please follow me over on X. Support Alex and the show, the InfoWars store, and I hope to see you in the future.